Chapter 4. The Slavs. In Eastern Europe, successions of regimes have been trying for 1,000 years and more to impose a viable political hegemony on the scores of ethnic and national groups in the area, invariably in vain. Forrest MacDonald. The Slavs of Eastern Europe have been both conquerors and conquered. Indeed, they were once part of a chain reaction of conquests in medieval Europe, as successive invaders from Central Asia drove portions of the Slavic population before them out of the Ukrainian steppes into the Balkans and into what is today East Central Europe, where the Slavs in turn forced the Celtic and Germanic populations farther west. In the later Middle Ages, Germanic invaders drove the Slavs back east of the Oder River. To the south, Slavic invaders in the Balkans drove the Vlachs before them and forced them up into the hills and mountains of the region. At various periods of history, the Slavs have also lived as conquered people under the Mongols, the Germans, the Bulgars, the Ottoman Turks, the Habsburg Empire, and, not least, under the rule of other branches of the Slavic peoples. Russian hegemony extended over Poles and Ukrainians, for example, as well as over non-Slavic peoples in the Caucasus, Central Asia, and the Baltic. Nations that were once great empires, Poland, Bohemia, Hungary, later found themselves subjugated by countries that had been nothing by comparison with themselves, Austria, Prussia, and Russia. Galling reversals of fortune such as these added the bitterness of history and the outrage of lost glory to contemporary grievances among the peoples of Eastern Europe in general, and among the Slavs in particular. The melange of fragmented peoples which made up the Habsburg Empire, as well as the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, added intergroup frictions to national longings for reunification with compatriots living under some other conqueror's heel. All of this combined to make Eastern Europe, during much of its history, a powder keg of ethnic violence, political assassinations, and mass uprisings brutally suppressed by autocratic powers, not to mention the national and international armies that have battled across this region time and again, devastating the land and its people. Like the other peoples of Eastern Europe and the Balkans, Slavs have historically lagged behind the peoples of Western Europe in technology, economic well-being, education, and other indices of development. This lag in economic and cultural development partly reflected great geographical differences between the two regions of the continent. Partly, also, it reflected the enduring effects of the Roman legacy in Western Europe and its absence in Eastern Europe. Geographic influences. Among the geographic advantages of Western Europe lacking in Eastern Europe has been ready access to the oceans of the world. While no point in Western Europe is more than 350 kilometers from the sea, there are parts of Eastern Europe more than 1,000 kilometers from the sea. The warming influence of the Gulf Stream, which moderates the winters in Western Europe, making them much milder than at corresponding latitudes in Asia or North America, is felt less and less to the east, where the continental climate is more bitterly cold in winter and the rivers are frozen for longer periods of time than the rivers of Western Europe. The Baltic Sea is likewise frozen for months at a time. In the Balkans, the mild, subtropical layer of the Mediterranean is blocked off by mountain ranges from reaching much of eastern and southeastern Europe, including the hinterlands of the Dalmatian coast. Because of the isolating effect of coastal mountains along the Adriatic shore, winter temperatures inland of Sarajevo may be nearly 50 degrees colder than on the coast, little more than 100 miles away. Many of the rivers of Eastern Europe flow into lakes or inland seas rather than out into the open waters of the oceans with their international trade routes, so that the benefits of low-cost access by water to the markets of the world and the ideas of the world have historically been far less available in the eastern part of the continent. In the rugged lands of the Balkans, largely lacking navigable rivers and cut off from access to the coast by mountains that come down close to the shore, it has been estimated that in Ottoman times, the cost of shipping wheat overland just 100 kilometers exceeded the value of the wheat itself. The painful economic implications of such high transport costs extended well beyond wheat to commerce and industry in general, and also help explain the cultural insularity which long plagued the region. While Western European nations became the center of trade networks that reached all parts of the world, much of Eastern Europe, and especially the Balkans, remained regions of self-sufficiency, which is to say, isolation, backwardness, and poverty. What foreign trade they had was based on supplying raw materials such as wool, grain, and lumber to Western European nations, from whom they bought manufactured goods. Climate and soil are also less favorable in the Balkans, which lacks the more consistent rainfall and more fertile soils of northwestern Europe. The fact that land capable of supporting human life often occurs in isolated patches in mountain valleys has meant that Balkan settlements have often developed in isolation from one another as well as from the outside world. For Russia, the colder winter climate of Eastern Europe compared to Western Europe means that, although the country has an abundance of rivers, those rivers are not abundantly available for use the year around, nor are the northern seaports, which are likewise frozen a substantial part of the year. Russia's warmer southern ports on the Black Sea have had to connect to the outside world through the narrow straits of the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, controlled by the Turks and by the Byzantines before them. Only after an 1829 treaty were Russian ships allowed through these straits, thus making large-scale grain shipments from Russia economically feasible. The difference that this made is indicated by the fact that Russian grain could then undersell Croatian grain on the Dalmatian coast, since the Russian grain was shipped at low cost by water and the Croatian grain by land, even though the latter was shipped for shorter distances. While many of the Slavic lands lack the natural resource abundance of Western Europe, Russia's rich deposits of coal, oil, and other resources make it one of the most fortunate countries of the world in that regard. However, only relatively recently in its history have Russia's human resources allowed it to realize much of the potential of its natural resources, for, as late as the end of the 19th century, the vast majority of Russians were still illiterate. As in other regions of the world, physical resources alone have meant little when the complementary human capital was missing. Cultural development. Cultural cross-currents have been as powerful and varied in Slavic Eastern Europe as the stormy military and political history of the region. After the Magyars invaded the Hungarian plain from the east during the Middle Ages, a wedge was driven between the Slavs of the Balkans and those farther north, leading to cultural cleavages which developed among the Slavic peoples over the centuries. However, even before this cultural divide was created, the Slavs had never been united politically. They lived as tribal peoples, with no national government for centuries. As with many other groups, the focus of their loyalty has often been much more local and not always ethnic. Such bitterly opposed peoples as the Serbs and the Croats, for example, are both Slavs, as are Czechs and Poles, Russians and Ukrainians, all of whose histories have been marked by strife with one another. Culturally, however, what has been most striking about the Slavs are their differences from peoples of Western Europe. East-West differences. Western civilization, the civilization of the Roman world and its cultural successors, came centuries later to the Slavs than to the French, the Germans, or the English. Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century, but the fact that the Slavs were still pagans in post-Roman times had great secular as well as religious significance, when the Catholic Church and the Latin language it used were a culturally unifying force in politically fragmented Europe and the principal source for learning on the continent. What education and scholarship survived the collapse of Rome in the West were largely the education and scholarship of the Church, so that educated people throughout Western Europe literally spoke the same language. An educated Frenchman understood the language of German intellectual writings or German universities as well as a German, for that language was Latin across wide regions of Europe. However, it was centuries later before the Slavs became part of this cultural universe. Moreover, their own cultural universe had no such rich literature as that of Western Europe. Indeed, it had no literature at all until written versions of Slavic languages were developed by scholars from other countries. While much of Eastern Europe and the Balkans have often been described as backward, either historically or today, These regions have, in fact, been like most of the rest of the world in their economic level and political development. They have been considered backward by comparison with the highly atypical development of a relative handful of Western European nations and their overseas offshoots, such as the United States or Australia. The cultural fault lines in Europe between the heirs of the Roman and Byzantine empires on the one hand, and those who remained outside this cultural orbit until much later in history, is just one of the sources of the differences in economic, social, and political developments in the various parts of Europe. Nor have these differences been small. At the beginning of the 19th century, per capita real income in Eastern Europe was only half of what it was in Great Britain, and, after Britain's industrial takeoff, only about a third as much by 1860. As late as the 20th century, real per capita incomes in parts of the Balkans were barely one-fourth of that in industrialized Western Europe. Such economic and other disparities go back for centuries. One of the most common and most unsubstantiated explanations of poverty has been overpopulation. But, at least as far back as the Middle Ages, population densities in Eastern Europe have been much lower than in Western Europe, whether measured by the ratio of people to land or people to arable land. Travelers in Eastern Europe in medieval times often commented on the vast amount of land lying unused. In Eastern Europe, as in Spain after its reconquest from the Moors, there was land for the asking. In both cases, there was poverty rather than the prosperity implied by the theory that overpopulation causes poverty. When the Slavs first moved into Eastern Europe in early medieval times, they practiced primitive slash-and-burn agriculture, but by the 7th century, they had largely changed to plowing. Nevertheless, Eastern European agricultural practices for centuries continued to lag behind those in Western Europe, both because the growing scarcity of farmland in Western Europe forced farmers there to try improved methods of cultivation, and because Western Europe inherited Greek and Roman legal principles of private property and land, while Eastern Europe lacked this cultural legacy and developed such principles only belatedly. Where Slavs followed practices more like those of Western Europe, they achieved results very similar to those in Western Europe. This tended to happen in areas culturally under German influence, such as Bohemia and Western Poland, both parts of Germanic empires. In the Balkans, where Christianity had existed, at least in the cities, during Roman times, the mass invasions of this region by Slavs during the Middle Ages brought the destruction of cities, the replacement of Christianity by paganism, and the replacement of a sophisticated urban life by a primitive rural existence. More generally, cultural differences between Eastern and Western Europeans were part of a larger and more enduring cultural gulf between those regions and peoples which had never been part of the Roman Empire or its Byzantine offshoot and successor, and those that were heirs of the cultural traditions established by Rome and Byzantium. This cultural divide was more salient than the strictly geographical divide, as indicated by the fact that pagan enclaves in early medieval Western Europe, such as Scotland and Denmark, likewise lagged economically and technologically behind those areas where Christianity was a token of a larger Roman cultural heritage, and paganism an index of a lack of this heritage. For example, although coins had been minted by the Romans, nevertheless there was no minting of coins in medieval Europe east of the Rhine before the 10th century AD, just as the Scots and the Danes minted no coins at that time. Coinage spread eastward along with Christianity and other features of Western European civilization, the minting of coins in Eastern Europe first taking place in Poland in the late 10th century and in Hungary in the early 11th century. Even after the Russian government began minting its own coins, as late as the 17th century, merchants in Russia rejected their country's kopecks in favor of higher quality coins from such countries as Germany, Holland, or Sweden. Printing presses appeared in many German and Italian communities during the 15th century, but it was the 17th century before such presses made their first appearances in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. Significantly, first in those parts of these regions culturally dominated by Germans. Even the building of artificial fish ponds began first in Western Europe and then moved, with a lag, eastward. The military technology developed during the Middle Ages, armored cavalry, stirrups, crossbows, castles, and siege machines, followed the same pattern of spreading from Christian to pagan Europe, the latter being primarily Eastern Europe, but also including Celtic and Scandinavian pagan enclaves and other lands more recently turned Christian. Paved streets, which existed in Italian cities in the 12th century and in the larger towns of Western Europe by the 15th century, appeared later in Eastern European cities and towns. Calico printing, which originated in Egypt, likewise spread from Western Europe to Eastern Europe. Textiles were imported into Eastern Europe from the West because the quality of Eastern European textiles was inferior. Among Jews, as among Christians, the Haskalah or Enlightenment movement began in Western Europe and then moved east. Cities in East Central Europe tended to be much smaller than cities in Western Europe. Historically, Eastern Europe tended to be a supplier of raw materials, such as grains, wood, and hides, to Western Europe, from which it purchased manufactured goods. One sign of this relationship was that trade routes in East Central Europe tended to run from east to west, and it was along these routes that the major fairs of the region were held. With disease control as well, Eastern and Southern Europe continued to lag behind the nations of the northwestern corner of the continent. Smallpox, for example, continued to ravage the peoples of Eastern Europe and the Balkans long after vaccinations had brought it under control elsewhere in Europe. Similar patterns appeared with railroad building. While railroads spread rapidly across Western Europe in the first half of the 19th century, they tended to spread later, more slowly, and on a smaller scale in Eastern Europe, and especially so in the Balkans. As late as 1860, there was not a mile of railroad track south of the Sava and the Danube. It was 1878 when the first railroad reached Serbia, and there were still relatively few railways in much of the Balkans, even on the eve of the First World War. Later in the 20th century, the automobile spread from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, as so many other technological advances had for centuries. Not only was physical infrastructure lacking in much of Eastern Europe and the Balkans, so too was such economic infrastructure as a money economy with financial, commercial, and industrial enterprises. Power looms replaced hand looms in the weaving of cotton in Western Europe by the mid-19th century, while hand looms continued to be used in Eastern Europe. Fairs continued to be important institutions in Eastern Europe after they were superseded in Western Europe by permanent stores and sophisticated distribution methods. Cloth and leather production continued as domestic activities in the East after they were organized in factories in the West. As many cities in Western and Central Europe grew several-fold in size during the 19th century, even towns remained rare in the Balkans, and there was no large city in southeastern Europe other than Constantinople. Even these striking disparities do not fully capture the lagging economic and technological development of the Slavic population, who were even less urbanized than the region in which they lived. Even though Slavs were the predominant population in medieval Eastern Europe, the towns and cities of that region had predominantly German, Jewish, and other non-Slavic populations. Similarly, in the Balkans, where the Slavs were also the predominant population, the larger the town in that region, the more likely it was to be Turkish. Slavs were primarily peasants in the countryside, living close to a subsistence level and having little margin for experimentation to discover better ways of working or living, or for keeping up with developments elsewhere. As late as the end of the 19th century, peasants in Serbia were said to be ignorant of places just 10 or 15 miles away. In the Austrian Empire in 1900, the illiteracy rate among Polish adults was 40%, among Serbo-Croatians 75%, and among Ruthenians 77%, compared to only 6% among Germans in the same empire. Such patterns were not limited to Slavs, however, but were common among the peoples of Eastern Europe and the Balkans in general. More than three-quarters of the Romanians, for example, were still illiterate as late as 1899, and on the eve of the First World War, half the Romanian children of school age were receiving no schooling. Not only was Romania a predominantly agricultural country, with four-fifths of its population living in rural areas as late as 1930, Romanians were even less urbanized than the various minorities who made up nearly 29% of the country's population. In many of the towns and cities of Romania, it was the Romanians who were not only a minority of the population, but were often also employed in subordinate roles as servants and unskilled laborers, while Germans, Jews, or others filled the higher level occupations. In the Romanian province of Bukovina, for example, only a third of the urban population was Romanian in 1930, while fewer than a third of the urban population of Bessarabia and just 35% of the urban population of Transylvania was Romanian. In short, the same regional features which held back the Slavs held back the Romanians and other non-Slavs, except for those like the Germans and the Jews, whose more advanced cultures originated elsewhere. For the peoples of Eastern Europe, isolation from the advances of Western civilization meant not only a loss of potential economic, medical, and other benefits, but also, and more fundamentally, an absence of the whole mindset characteristic of modern commercial and industrial societies. A story about a Ruthenian man who was asked what he would charge to shingle a roof is illustrative. He was dismayed at the idea of undertaking such a contract and refused to make any estimate. A Jew was then given the contract, and he came to the same man and offered him a fixed sum, which was accepted, for shingles and shingling, making, of course, his own profit on the business. Here, the Jewish contractor played a role familiar to middleman minorities around the world, serving as a cultural intermediary to get things done that were mutually beneficial to parties who were prevented by cultural barriers from making the same transaction directly themselves. Often such middlemen are blamed for exploitation, but the more fundamental problem is that the other potential transactors are in different cultural universes. In language and literature as well, the Slavs of Eastern Europe and the Balkans lagged behind the peoples of Western Europe. Although the languages and the literature of the Greeks and Romans went back thousands of years and were known to educated people in Western Europe, the Slavic languages had no writings at all until the Middle Ages, when written versions of these languages were first created by others, either by adaptations of the Latin alphabet or by creation of a Cyrillic alphabet based upon the Greek language. Only then could the small literate class in Eastern Europe and the Balkans begin to create a Slavic literature, though even they often chose to write in Latin or in one of the vernacular languages of Western Europe, especially when writing on serious subjects. While the rendering of Slavic languages into a written version began as early as the 9th century, it was the 16th century before Polish was rendered into Latin letters. Moreover, while some Slavic languages were rendered in Latin letters, others, such as Russian, were rendered into the Cyrillic script used in the Byzantine Empire. Modern Serbo-Croatian differs in its Serbian version from its Croatian version primarily by the fact that the former is written in Latin letters and the latter in Cyrillic script. More than a rendering of sounds into writing was necessary, however, for Slavic languages, like other European vernaculars of the early Middle Ages, lacked the ability to express as complex and sophisticated ideas as such classical languages as Latin or Greek. These classical languages had ancient philosophical texts and other advanced intellectual writings of a sort dealt with by an educated elite, while the vernacular languages were the languages of peasants, shepherds, and others whose lives were more narrowly circumscribed in terms of their cultural exposures. Even after the Slavic languages acquired written versions, the writings in these languages were at first not merely meager in quantity, but also very limited in the subjects covered. Even Czech nationalists wrote in German when publishing patriotic or anti-German tracts. Nationalistic promoters of the Czech language in the 18th century published primarily children's stories, light romantic novels, or material translated from German or other languages. This was because the masses were the only real market for writings in the Czech language, since educated Czechs were used to reading more sophisticated material in German, Latin, or other languages that had a large and serious world literature. When the Ukrainian and Belarusian languages were first used in plays, the point was to provide dialogue for comic characters or to make fun of these languages. Moreover, the fact that most Russians, Serbs, and Bulgarians were Greek Orthodox and wrote in the Cyrillic script, while most Poles, Bohemians, and Croatians were Roman Catholic and wrote in Latin letters, created moral cleavages among the Slavs, as well as making it more difficult for those unfamiliar with Latin letters to follow cultural, economic, and political developments in Western Europe. Cultural transfers. Over the centuries, much of the advancement of agriculture in Eastern Europe was due to the movement of better methods of cultivation from Western Europe. These included improved plows, the horse collar, and new systems of crop rotation. Sometimes this movement of agricultural advances was accompanied by a movement of people from Western Europe, mostly Germans, who were welcomed by Polish, Hungarian, and other Eastern and Central European landed nobility for the greater prosperity they would bring to the region. In order to attract them, these migrants were often given concessions on land, taxes, and tithes, and local laws and practices were held in abeyance, so that villages and towns were allowed to rule themselves according to German law. In Silesia alone, there were 200 villages under German law at the end of the 13th century, and 1,200 by the middle of the 14th century, when there were also 120 towns under German law. This law not only spread through urban communities in Eastern Europe, it spread to people who were not German, but who settled in these communities. Still, for much of medieval Eastern Europe, urbanization and cultural Germanization occurred together, just as urbanization and Anglicization went together in medieval Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. Prior to the year 1312, the official records of the city of Krakow were kept in German, and the transition, at that point, was to Latin. Only decades later did Poles become a majority of the population in Krakow. The number of Germans settling east of the Elbe-Saale line in the 12th century alone has been estimated as 200,000 at a time when populations in general were much smaller than today, so that this number of Germans settling in Eastern Europe meant far more than a similar transplantation of people would mean in modern times. Altogether, by the mid-17th century, an estimated 1 million Germans had moved into Eastern Europe. German cultural penetration of Eastern Europe was aided in some cases by the imposition of German agricultural practices on local peasants by the ruling Polish authorities. The towns of medieval East Central Europe were cultural enclaves of foreigners, again mostly Germans, but with many Jews as well, and in the Balkans, Greeks and Armenians, joined in later centuries by Turks. There were Latin quarters, where Frenchmen lived in two leading Hungarian towns, and there were predominantly German mining communities in the Balkans. It was not simply that foreigners congregated in towns. Most of the inhabitants of those towns were foreign, some of the towns being created by foreign settlers. But with the Slavs, in any case, being an overwhelmingly agricultural people with little or no urban background and few urban skills. Even where there were some native-born merchants in East Central Europe, they were usually no match for the experienced merchants who came from Western Europe and other places with a long history of commerce. In Croatia and Transylvania, most of the towns founded during the Middle Ages were founded by Germans, while such port cities as Dubrovnik developed under Italian cultural influences, even when their populations were Slavic, and Sarajevo owed much of its development to the Ottoman Turks. Most of the Germans who migrated went to live under Slavic or Magyar rulers, though in some cases German knights and nobles conquered Slavic regions and subjugated the people living in them. In other cases, local nobles invited in German knights who served under them and over the Slavic masses. However, some lands passed back and forth between German and Slavic control, as in the case of Brandenburg, for example. Through one process or another, the culturally German regions of Central and Eastern Europe expanded during medieval times. Even such classically German cities as Berlin and Lübeck only became German in the Middle Ages, while much of the land to the east of what is modern Germany also felt the cultural impact of Germans. It was German priests, for example, who converted the Czechs to Christianity. The German role in Eastern Europe left as one legacy German words in the Slavic languages of the region. The word for fief, for example, in both the Czech and Polish languages, is based on the German word for fief, and words taken from German appear in the language of Hungary for such military things as helmet, armor, and castle. The Polish words for last, pound, and ballast also derive from the corresponding German words. The German language influenced the syntax as well as the vocabulary of the Czech language, and one of the dialects of Serbo-Croatian contains numerous German and Hungarian words. German cultural influence was also shown when the rulers of the medieval Slavic peoples of Mecklenburg began to give their children German names. Many of the first teachers in Poland, Bohemia, and Hungary came from Western Europe. The first university in Eastern Europe, the University of Prague, was founded in 1348 with a predominantly German faculty. Resentment of this German predominance by native Czech scholars led to preferential treatment for Czechs, which in turn led to an exodus of Germans, which then led to a closing down of the university for years. Thus was enacted a drama repeated in many other parts of the world over many centuries. A transfer of cultural capital hindered or aborted by the politics of resentment. The importance of this cultural capital is indicated by the fact that it was not those parts of Eastern Europe most abundantly supplied with natural resources which became the most economically prosperous regions, but rather those with the most abundant contacts with Western Europe, Bohemia, for example, rather than Russia. Romania, despite its rich soil, had low crop yields because its agricultural practices lagged behind those of Western Europe. East Central Europe. Over the centuries, the political boundaries between the nations of Eastern Europe and the Balkans have shifted greatly, including the disappearance and reappearance of whole countries, such as Poland and Ukraine. The very definition of East Central Europe has reflected the turmoil which so often marked the unsettled history of that region. Some have defined it geographically as lands lying west of Russia and east of Germany, or more precisely, as lands bounded by particular rivers, mountains, and seas. Others have defined it linguistically as the region bounded by peoples speaking the German, Italian, and Russian languages. Such a variety of other definitions have come and gone that it has been claimed that the region has been defined at one time or another to include virtually every part of Europe except the Iberian Peninsula. Yet the central core of the region can be considered as being the lands comprising today Poland, Hungary, Romania, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and the Balkan countries. Since the early Middle Ages, Slavs have been demographically predominant among the varied peoples of this region. The shifting political boundaries, which reflect the military conflicts that have plagued the region over the centuries, both world wars of the 20th century having started in East Central Europe, are also reflected in the multiple names that many of the prominent cities in Eastern Central Europe have had, Gdansk having also been Danzig, Kaliningrad having also been Konigsberg, Bratislava having also been Pressburg, and so on. Mosques converted to churches likewise show the shifting fortunes of conquest and reconquest in the Balkans. In medieval and early modern times, the Slavs of East Central Europe were caught in the crossfire between the rival empires of the Ottomans and the Habsburgs, as they would again be caught between rival big power blocs throughout most of the 20th century. Although Slavs have been the predominant population in East Central Europe for centuries, such groups as the Jews and the Armenians lived in parts of Eastern Europe before the Slavs, who are often thought of as indigenous to the region. At the end of the 19th century, for example, there were nearly 2 million Germans in Hungary and more than 3 million in Poland, in addition to more than 2 million Turks in East Central Europe as a whole, and nearly 7.5 million Jews in Eastern Europe, including Russia. However, these non-Slavs were outnumbered by Poles alone, who were 15 million people scattered throughout Austria, Germany, and Russia. Still, the non-Slavs were not a negligible element, and the various Slavs were also scattered as minorities in other Slavic and non-Slavic countries. These ethnic cross-currents have been accompanied by religious cross-currents, with Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, and Muslim clashes, as well as major heresies such as the Hussite movement among the Czechs in the 15th century. Overlaying all this were numerous dynastic struggles and struggles between kings and their own powerful nobles. Few regions of the world have had such fragmented peoples and cultures or such intractable conflicts. The interpenetration of cultures was often bitterly contested. Those who felt superior did not want their superiority diluted by inferior cultures, and those who resented the more fortunate economic and social conditions of others sought to band together to seek their own privileges. Thus, some German guilds in Eastern Europe barred Slavs from membership, and other legislation prescribed expulsion for any member who married a Slav. As for the Slavs, their anti-German views were manifested in many ways. Such verbal descriptions of Germans as "this crafty and deceitful race" were symptoms of a hostility expressed also in a pogrom against Germans in 14th century Krakow and by a barring of any German, cleric or lay, from holding a position in a Polish hospital founded in the 14th century. An Augustinian house founded among the Czechs in the same century likewise required that anyone admitted must be born from two Czech-speaking parents. Whatever the economic and social benefits from cross-cultural interactions, they left sore feelings that could be and were exploited politically, not only in the Middle Ages, but on into the 20th century as well. In Prague, for example, the struggle between Czechs and Germans persisted, whether it was ruled by the Austro-Hungarian Empire or in an independent Czechoslovakia and its successor states during World War II, as well as in the post-war era. The cultural Germanization of educated Czechs was such that, as far back as the 18th century, a movement to revive the Czech language as a literary language and a language of the stage was launched with great difficulty. Despite the eventual success of this movement and its laying the foundations for later and more ambitious Czech nationalism, even for much of the 19th century, it was said to be unheard of for any army officer to speak in Czech. For more than two centuries, the government of Prague was in the hands of German-speaking officials until Czechs achieved a majority on the city council in the early 1860s and then gained control of local government in general by the 1880s. One symbolic milestone came in 1892, when the city's street signs, which had been written in both German and Czech, now became exclusively Czech. The cultural clash between the two groups during this era largely revolved around language. German had long been the language of the most prosperous and influential residents of Prague, so that even Czechs and Jews who aspired to rise economically and socially not only learned the German language, but also became absorbed into local German cultural life. German was the language of the city's educated classes, the language in which business was conducted, as well as the language of the higher ranks of the military and the clergy, regardless of whether the individuals involved were of German ancestry or not. By the 19th century, culture, rather than ancestry, was the defining social characteristic, and Germans in Prague took pride in being cosmopolitan Bohemians and part of the Habsburg Empire, rather than being narrowly ethnic Germans. It was the Czechs who began to promote ethnic or nationalistic group identity, led by a newly arising Czech intelligentsia, as so much nationalism in other countries around the world has been led by newly arising intelligentsias. In addition to producing a literature in the Czech language, these intellectuals, often the well-educated but underemployed sons of Czech artisans and other city dwellers of modest prosperity, began to make ethnic appeals in order to build a following among the masses. While the Germans continued for some years to favor a Bohemian identity for all, rather than specifically ethnic identities, eventually the rise of Czech nationalism provoked in response a countervailing German ethnic consciousness. In the aftermath of this ethnic polarization, Germans and Czechs began to separate more and more into their own social organizations, and the political agitation of the Czechs produced mass violence against German and Jewish businesses in Prague and other Bohemian cities. Meanwhile, aspiring Czechs sought government positions, both in politics and in the state bureaucracy, while Germans and Jews continued to dominate commerce and industry. After the formation of Czechoslovakia after the First World War, the government began preferential treatment of Czechs over other ethnic groups. It was a classic pattern, followed by other aspiring groups of various races in other countries around the world. The politicized Balkanization of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in general reached a climax at the end of the First World War, when the empire surrendered to the Allies and its army fragmented into ethnic components. Subjugation. Like other culturally fragmented, economically backward, and politically disunited peoples around the world, the Slavs of East Central Europe were subjugated in many ways, as serfs owned by their own or foreign nobles, as slaves sold in the slave markets of Europe and the Middle East, and as peoples conquered by the Ottoman, Habsburg, and other empires. Such fates appeared in succession or in combinations over a period of centuries. Most of the Slavs of medieval Europe were for centuries either peasants or animal herders, predominantly the former in the plains and a mixture of the two in the uplands. Initially, when the invading Slavs settled down to agriculture in the 6th and 7th centuries, serfdom was unknown. But in an era when organized national governments had not yet developed in the region, peasants often sought the protection of militarily powerful nobles for physical safety in a chaotic and violent age. Over a period of time, this dependence degenerated into serfdom in much, but not all, of East Central Europe. Serfdom entailed not merely subservience, but also a loss of the right to move. Serfs who sought to flee were often tortured when captured, sometimes by having their hair set on fire and their noses split. Below the serfs on the social scale were the slaves, the main differences between them being that serfs belonged to the land and were supposed to be sold only jointly with the land, rather than as personal property that could be sold separately anywhere at any time. Moreover, serfs had certain rights, though the fact that most of these rights were enforceable only in courts set up by noble landowners made those rights somewhat tenuous when it came to disputes with those landowners themselves. Slaves, however, lacked even these precarious protections and could be bought, sold, bartered, or even killed by their owners. Sometimes people were enslaved locally for crimes or for debt, and some poverty-stricken peasants sold their children into slavery in order to survive when the family could not feed itself. The institution of slavery was common within East Central Europe, and foreign marauders and conquering armies also carried off Slavs into bondage in other lands, including Spain, Germany, Egypt, and Syria. An international study of slavery described the Dalmatian coast as one of the most continuously productive sources of slaves in human history, drawing not only from the largely Slavic population of that region, but also from Slavic and other peoples from farther east in the Caucasus and the Balkans. Centuries before the first African was carried in bondage to the Western Hemisphere, Slavs were being enslaved on a massive scale, Russians by the hundreds of thousands being enslaved by Turkish raiders, and Slavs along the Dalmatian coast being enslaved by other Europeans for at least 6 centuries, while various groups of Slavs sold one another into bondage, as well as competing with Iranians, Turks, and others to enslave before being enslaved. Slavs were so widely sold into bondage that the very word for slave was derived from the word for Slav in a number of Western European languages, as well as in Arabic. Behind this history lay a set of geographical factors. Like other long-lasting slave export areas, the Dinaric Highlands had certain environmental features that fostered poverty, population pressure, political fragmentation, and conflict. A coastal ridge rises like a wall from the sea. Further inland, other ridges form folds parallel to the Adriatic. They effectively separate the inhabited regions into long, narrow valleys called polya, each isolated from the other by barren mountain chains, where pasture is scant, communication difficult. The few rivers that pierce the walls are unnavigable. The narrow gorges they cut could not until recently be used by wheeled vehicles. Because of the complexity of the mountain environment, however, natural disasters were usually local, sometimes confined to a single valley. This resulted in an intense competition for resources, most often expressed through banditry and feud. While the geography of this area differed in various ways from that of Africa, the net effects of that geography on the people were quite similar in producing a cultural and political disunity that made both peoples vulnerable and prey to outsiders. As in the case of Africa, those who did the capturing of people were not usually the same as those who engaged in the trading of slaves. In both regions, as well as in other parts of the world, warriors, brigands, and pirates initially captured the people, while ordinary merchants then included slaves among the merchandise that they sold. Thus, much of the slave trade of medieval Europe was carried on by Jews, though many of the slave trading centers were in such Christian strongholds as Venice and Dubrovnik, just as merchant peoples, such as the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia or the Yao in Central Africa, also included their fellow human beings among the merchandise they sold. Nor was this practice at all controversial at the time. Within East Central Europe itself, local noblemen found that serfdom was more profitable than slavery, which accordingly began dying out in the later Middle Ages. As for people being enslaved by outsiders, the consolidation of strong territorial states in the late medieval and early modern era was a key factor in the decline of such enslavement in Eastern Europe, as in other parts of the world. The rise of the Muscovite state meant that anyone attempting to enslave Russians now faced a national army, and the rise of other territorial states in Eastern Europe likewise surrounded their peoples with military power too formidable for marauders to confront. The difficulties of establishing such large nation-states in the rugged uplands of the Balkans left the peoples of this area vulnerable longer. However, the establishment of states in this region, and of empires ruling over this region, ended its role as a major source of slaves. By the time Western Europeans established colonies across the Atlantic and sought to have much of the work there done by slaves, Africa was one of the few remaining viable sources. The conquests of the Ottoman Empire in medieval southeastern Europe brought many Slavs under the dominion of the Turks, whose exactions included a regular levy of male children, who were taken away as slaves to be converted to Islam and trained for military posts in the corps of the Janissaries or in various civil positions as functionaries of the Ottoman government. Between 15,000 and 20,000 children were taken away from their parents during the 30-year reign of Sultan Muhammad the Conqueror in the 15th century, for example, and the practice did not die out until the latter part of the 17th century, by which time approximately 200,000 boys had been taken from their families in this way. Not all these children were Slavs, since this human levy applied to conquered Christians in general, but in practice, many of these children were Slavs, and relatively few were Greeks or Armenians. Ottoman rule in the Balkans lasted 5 centuries and left a lasting imprint on the subsequent history of the region. To varying degrees and for varying lengths of time, it removed many Europeans from the cultural development of the rest of Europe at a crucial time in the evolution of the continent. Like all non-Muslim conquered peoples in the Ottoman Empire, the Slavs were explicitly assigned a lower position in the laws and policies of the empire. Moreover, even within the Christian community, recognized officially by the Ottoman authorities, the Slavs were assigned to be part of the Greek Orthodox structure, making them subordinate in both religious and secular matters to the Greeks. However, conditions following the Ottoman conquests were usually better than the conditions on the eve of that conquest for the vast majority of the peoples of southeastern Europe. For all its harsh and unequal laws, the Ottoman Empire did establish the rule of law in an area previously devastated and disorganized by warfare and among people previously living under the arbitrary caprices of their own nobles. With these nobles forced to flee in the wake of Ottoman conquest, and with Ottoman laws making the lot of the peasant less onerous, serfdom no longer existed under the Ottomans, for example, there was initially no substantial popular resistance for being ruled from Istanbul. Only in the later centuries of the empire, when control from the top was weakened and subordinate officials in Istanbul and in the provinces gained more power and became more corrupt and overbearing toward the people under them, did resistance to Ottoman rule begin to become serious among the Slavs and among the other peoples of southeastern Europe. Although southeastern Europe was racked for centuries by wars between various Christian European rulers and the Ottoman Empire, the division was by no means always neatly split along either religious or ethnic lines. When Sultan Bayezid I fought against the Hungarians and Wallachians in the 14th century, for example, his troops included Serbs. Moreover, the vassals of the Ottoman Empire usually included Christian princes, who were expected to fight alongside the Ottoman Turks, and often did so in practice. Initially, the Ottoman Empire was one of the more tolerant states toward those with different religions, certainly more tolerant than contemporary medieval Europe was toward Jews or toward Christians with heterodox views. Despite Islamic laws putting Muslims on a higher plane, forcing non-Muslim subjects to pay higher taxes and to submit to numerous other restrictions, serious and petty, there was far more tolerance of near equality in practice in the early centuries of the expanding empire than in the later centuries of the empire's decline and decay. Moreover, purely ethnic differences meant much less than religious differences. Part of this tolerance reflected the reality that a majority of the subjects of the empire were not Muslims in the early centuries. Only after the later conquests of the 16th century did the Ottoman Empire have a Muslim majority, and it was then that intolerance toward non-Muslims developed. More than demographic changes were involved, however. In its earlier expanding and all-conquering era, the Ottoman Empire was confident in its mission to spread Islam, its superiority as a culture, and its military invincibility. European armies and coalitions failed time and again to stop the advance of the Ottoman forces toward the heart of the continent. Even when the Ottoman army was turned back from the gates of Vienna in 1532, it was because the impending arrival of winter made a continuation of the siege impractical, rather than because the European forces opposing them were too formidable. In later centuries, however, the relative strengths of the Ottoman Empire and its European rivals shifted. The rise of the Habsburg Empire as a power in Central Europe and of the Russian Empire in Eastern Europe brought formidable new adversaries to the fore, and the rise of Venice as a naval power and the later rise of Western Europe as a force to be reckoned with as well marked the relative decline of the Ottoman Empire as a military power. Its sense of cultural superiority was also undermined by the economic, social, and intellectual advances of early modern Western Europe. Long disdainful of European civilization, whose more backward regions it encountered in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, the Ottoman Empire made no real effort to stay abreast of developments in Western Europe and was constantly surprised and shocked when the Western Europeans eventually overtook them in both cultural and military terms. Having routed European armies on the battlefields for centuries, the Ottomans now began to suffer crushing defeats at their hands, seeing more advanced weaponry than they could match, and watching European naval and military forces striking at Ottoman territory, while European subject populations revolted against Ottoman rule. It was in this atmosphere of defeat, danger, and disillusionment that the Ottomans turned against their own Christian subjects, whom they now resented as potential traitors. To the Christians, the breakdown of law and order within the empire, and in particular the depredations of corrupt Ottoman officials and uncontrollable troops sent out to the provinces precisely because they were considered dangerous in the capital, destroyed whatever loyalty was left among the conquered peoples and eventually provoked armed resistance, the climax of which was the Serbian War for Independence in the early 19th century. Thus, the Ottoman Empire, whose early rise was marked by a crushing military victory against the Serbs at Kosovo in the late 14th century, now saw its declining era marked by the successful revolt of the Serbs. For the Serbs, as for other Slavic peoples living for centuries under Ottoman rule, that subjugation entailed cultural isolation from developments in the rest of Europe, while the religious compartmentalization imposed by Ottoman authorities isolated them from the dominant Muslim culture, except for those who converted to Islam. Moreover, the cultural subordination of the Slavs to the Greeks within the Orthodox community, to which they were assigned by the Ottomans, likewise inhibited the development of a distinctly Slavic culture in the Balkans. A striking exception, however, was the vassal city-state of Dubrovnik on the Adriatic coast, which the Ottomans allowed to run its own affairs in exchange for annual tribute. As a port city open to the trade and ideas of the West, Dubrovnik was influenced by Italian culture, but also became a center for the development of the culture of the southern Slavs. Classics of Western European culture were translated into the languages of the Slavs, and original literary works began to be written in the Slavic languages in Dubrovnik, in contrast to the largely oral folk culture of Slavs living under direct Ottoman rule. Architects and painters also flourished in Dubrovnik, though their work, too, remained largely unknown among the Slavs of the interior. In this way, Dubrovnik and other cities and towns along the Dalmatian coast were outposts of Western European culture and at the same time were places where a higher Slavic culture, as distinguished from a folk culture, could develop, much as in other parts of East Central Europe in closer touch with Western Europe were able to participate in the general cultural advances of the continent over the centuries. The other great empire in which the Slavs of East Central Europe lived as conquered peoples was the Habsburg Empire. Here, the relationships of the various Slavic peoples to the ruling powers was much more complicated than that of a simple conquered and conqueror relationship. Because the Habsburg Empire was an agglomeration of lands with a variety of histories involving prior conquests, there were sometimes layers of overlords, such as the Hungarians over the Croats, all now subject to the Germanic rulers of the empire. These rulers might mitigate or aggravate the situations of those at the bottom, depending upon the changing political relationships between the ruling powers and the intermediate nobility. In turn, this meant that the Croats, for example, might at a given time have more loyalty to the ruling Habsburgs than to the Hungarians directly over them. Thus, Croatian nationalism, directed against the Hungarians' attempts at Croatian Magyarization, was not seen initially as a threat to the empire and received qualified support from the Habsburgs. This was only one of many cross-currents among the various ethnic groups, estates, and nationalities comprising the Habsburg Empire, where there were power struggles and cultural clashes between Germans and Slovaks, Serbs and Hungarians, and among others. Within these cross-currents, however, what is clear is that intellectuals took the lead in promoting nationalism in both cultural and political terms. Whether among the Czechs, the Serbs, the Croats, or other groups, it was the intelligentsia, including students and lawyers, who promoted group identity in opposition to cultural absorption by either the Germanic or Magyar culture, while the peasant masses were slow to respond to calls for heightened ethnic or national identity. But, although the Habsburg Empire was riven by internal struggles, it held together until dismembered by the Western powers after the First World War. The emergence of Slavic nations. Unlike the emergence of some peoples from tribal societies to national states through internal consolidations, whether peaceful or bloody, the emergence of modern Slavic states has been largely through armed struggles against foreign conquerors. The uprisings of the Serbs against the Ottoman Empire and the Russians driving back of Mongol conquerors, before conquering them in turn, have been part of a pattern of the emergence of Slavic peoples into nation-states of their own. Poland has likewise played the role of both conqueror and conquered, including its obliteration as an independent state for more than a century following the carving up of its territory by Russia, Prussia, and Austria in 1795. The collapse and dismemberment of the Habsburg and Ottoman empires in the wake of the First World War freed more Slavic peoples to form more nation-states, for the first time in the case of Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, and as an historic resurrection in the case of Poland. Poland. The Poland that emerged at the end of the First World War had very different borders from the Poland which existed in the 13th to 15th centuries, much less the expansive Poland that once included Lithuania and Ukraine in the 16th century, when the Polish Commonwealth was one of the dominant powers on the European continent. The country's dismemberment at the end of the 18th century resulted in Russia's acquiring 62% of Poland's land and 45% of its people, with Prussia taking 20% of the land and 23% of the people, while Austria took 18% of the land and 32% of the people. This partition of Poland meant not only the Poles' loss of political independence, but also that Polish producers and their markets were now often separated by national boundaries, and the varying policies of the three conquering nations led to very different roles for the Poles in the differing larger economies of which they were now a part. Railroads, for example, connected the Polish regions of Russia, Prussia, and Austria, not with each other, but with other regions of the respective empires of which they were now part. Although Poland had been and remained well into the 20th century a predominantly agricultural country, such industrial development as took place there in the 18th and 19th centuries, using imported Western European technology and then Western European investment, made the Polish regions of the Russian Empire the most industrially advanced part of the Tsarist realm. The real wages of industrial workers in these Polish regions were accordingly higher than the real wages of industrial workers in Russia as a whole, though lower than the real wages of such workers in Western Europe. This was in keeping with the intermediary role of the Polish provinces as conduits for Western technology moving eastward into the less developed Russian Empire. In Prussia, however, the role of the Polish regions was quite different. Prussia, and especially the United Germany which succeeded it, was a nation with earlier access to Western European technology. Here, the Poles played a very different role, as suppliers of agricultural produce and raw materials for German industry, as well as supplying both agricultural laborers and a workforce for parts of German industry. But, although Poles tended to be backward parts of the German economy, as contrasted with advanced parts of the Russian economy, the absolute standard of living of Poles under German hegemony was higher than that of Poles living under either Russian or Austrian rule, simply because the Germans had a more advanced economy than those of their neighbors to the east and south. Poles in Germany were not simply passive recipients of a higher standard of living, however. They were better educated and harder working than fellow Poles living in Russia or in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Their agriculture was better organized, increasingly used machinery, and had higher yields than farms in the Polish regions of Russia. It was the Poles from Prussia who constituted most of the skilled workers among Polish immigrants to the United States. In the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Austrian and the Czech regions were in the forefront of Western technology and industry, while the Poles in Galicia supplied agricultural products and other raw materials. Moreover, poverty was rampant in this province. The estimated per capita food consumption in Galicia in the late 19th century was only half that in Europe as a whole. Yet, in this empire, there were fewer restrictions on the Polish language and culture than in Russia or Prussia, so that Galicia became a cultural center for Poles in the late 19th century, with an influence radiating into the Polish communities of neighboring countries. Moreover, stringent restrictions on the Polish language and culture in Russia and Prussia were not always effective and were not supinely accepted by the Poles. For example, a crackdown by the Tsarist secret police in 1882-1883 uncovered 100 clandestine Polish schools. At the same time, Lithuanian and Ukrainian nationalism were developing, destroying the political and cultural ties they had once had with the Poles in an earlier era, when they were all part of the Polish Commonwealth, so that the re-establishment of that Commonwealth was no longer even a goal among these people living under Russian rule, who were now seeking an independent Lithuania, an independent Ukraine, and an independent Poland. Despite a variety of political movements and unsuccessful insurrections among the Poles, and a variety of changing responses by the conquering nations, as the 19th century neared its end, there was little indication that an independent Poland was going to be reconstituted in the foreseeable future. On the other hand, there was little indication of Polish satisfaction with their existing situation. During the era of mass emigration from 1870 to 1914, there was heavy emigration of Poles from the Polish regions of Russia, Prussia, and Galicia, more than 1 million people from each of these regions. However, economic progress continued largely through the importation of the technology of Western Europe. Electricity, for example, came into wider use, and Warsaw and several other Polish cities had their own power plants. Between 1894 and 1904, electric streetcars began to run in Warsaw, Lemberg, and Krakow, and telephones and automobiles began to appear, at least among the prosperous. During the course of the First World War, Germany and Austria invaded Russia, and the territory they conquered included the Polish regions of that country, giving these powers control of all historic Poland. However, at the end of the war, the victory of the Western Allies and the weakness of the new communist government in Moscow left the West with the question of how to dispose of the lands of the defeated powers. Their decision was to recreate Poland. When Poland was reconstituted as an independent nation, it was composed of regions that had developed economically as parts of the very different economies of Russia, Germany, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and had of course reached very different levels of development. Railroad networks, for example, were far more developed in the Polish regions of Germany than in the Polish regions of Russia, simply because Germany was a more economically developed country. More important, the Poles in the western region of Poland, having been part of the German economy, were a more economically developed people. In the ex-Prussian western regions, both the peasantry and the bourgeoisie were economically enterprising. In the southern and eastern regions, the peasantry was generally more primitive, and the Polish middle class was heavily composed of members of the professions and bureaucrats, allowing the specifically economic bourgeoisie to remain predominantly Jewish. Even the landscape reflected these differences. In the ex-German areas, frequent small towns, which were loci of agricultural marketing and processing industries, and collieries and foundries dotted the countryside, while in much of the rest of Poland, the endless vista of fields, forests, and villages interspersed with an occasional city, which functioned mainly as an administrative and garrison center, prevailed. During the war that preceded its independence, and which made that independence possible, Poland had suffered major economic and social losses in the battles that raged across its territory under different flags. These losses included the destruction of more than 40% of its bridges, 63% of its railroad stations, and 48% of the rolling stock. In addition, 450,000 Poles were killed in the war, fighting in the armies of the various contending powers. More fundamental than even these large losses, which could be made up over time, was the fact that Poland was still not a major industrial nation. As late as the 1930s, only 30% of its population was urban. Czechoslovakia. Although Czechoslovakia, like Poland, was created by the victorious Western powers from the territories of the nations defeated in the First World War, Czechoslovakia did not represent the recreation of a state that had once existed, but the synthesizing of a new state from ethnically and economically disparate elements. The medieval kingdom of Bohemia, the Czech heartland, was reconstituted as a province of Czechoslovakia, but the Slovaks were only with some difficulty persuaded to add Slovakia to it, and smaller territories, once part of Poland and Hungary, were added to round out Czechoslovakia economically. Nearly half the population of the country lived in Bohemia, which was also the most economically and culturally advanced part of Czechoslovakia. The illiteracy rate in Bohemia was only 2% in 1921, compared to 50% in the province of Ruthenia. This was symptomatic of other large disparities among the peoples and regions of Czechoslovakia, where only about two-thirds of the population was either Czech or Slovak. Ethnic strife was to plague the history of Czechoslovakia between the two world wars and lead ultimately to its breakup into a Czech Republic and an independent Slovakia in the last decade of the 20th century. As a nation emerging after the First World War, Czechoslovakia was more fortunate than Poland or some other parts of East Central Europe, for it had sustained little damage from the war that led to its independence. Moreover, Czechoslovakia was the most economically prosperous of the states to emerge from the dismemberment of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and produced half the steel and pig iron in all of East Central Europe. However, four-fifths of the population was still rural. In the Slovak capital of Bratislava, Slovaks were still only a minority, with most of the other inhabitants being either Germans or Hungarians. Much of the country's industrial development was in the western province of Bohemia, and a substantial proportion of it was in the hands of the Sudeten German minority there, the largest German population outside Germany and Austria. Creation of the Czechoslovakian state did not put an end to the internal ethnic strife between Czechs and Germans, which had become sharper in the preceding century. Rather, the new state became only a new arena for that strife, which led to even greater tragedies for both Czechs and Germans. Like other newly independent peoples, the Czechs, after the First World War, used their newfound power to discriminate against their own minorities. In addition to preferential hiring of Czechs in the civil service, the government was also instrumental in transferring capital from German and German-Jewish banks to Czech banks, and in breaking up German-owned large estates to be made into smaller farms for the benefit of the Czech peasantry. The more fundamental and intractable problem, however, was that the Germans in Bohemia did not want to be part of the new Czech state in the first place, and asserted that the right of self-determination of nations which had created Czechoslovakia should apply to them as well. The interspersed German and Czech areas of the Bohemian borderlands made a separate German territory not feasible. More important, from the standpoint of maintaining militarily defensible borders, Germans were concentrated near the mountainous border areas, and their secession would have eliminated the new country's geographical defenses. Violent German protests against the denial of their claims to self-determination led to the Czech armies opening fire and killing more than 50 Germans. The internal ethnic strife in the new country during the 1920s was later exacerbated by the rise of the Nazis to power in neighboring Germany during the 1930s, leading to a strident Nazi movement among the embittered Germans of Czechoslovakia. All this culminated in the Munich Crisis of 1938, in which Czechoslovakia was dismembered under threat of invasion from Germany. Czechoslovakia's western, predominantly German Sudeten region was annexed by Hitler. 6 months later, Germany took control of all of Czechoslovakia, which remained under their control for the next 6 years, a traumatic period of many atrocities committed against Czechs and Slovaks, and preferential treatment given to Germans, many of whom responded with loyalty to the Nazi cause. A bitter backlash followed after the Second World War ended. Both unofficial violence and official discrimination were instituted against Germans per se, and only those who could offer proof of their loyalty to the Czechoslovakian cause were allowed to retain their citizenship. Ultimately, more than 3 million Germans were expelled from Czechoslovakia at the end of the war, leaving behind a German population less than one-tenth of what it had been in 1930. The fact that more than 18,000 Germans of demonstrated loyalty to Czechoslovakia also chose to leave on their own also spoke volumes about the ethnic polarization in the country. Nor were these Germans readily replaced. Half a century later, there were still deserted towns and farmhouses in the Sudetenland from which the Germans had been expelled. The fact that the Soviet army had driven the Nazis out of Czechoslovakia did not mean liberation, but incorporation into the Soviet bloc of Eastern European nations that did not regain independence until the last decade of the 20th century. For Czechoslovakia, it was more than half a century since it had been a free nation. While the mass expulsions of Germans from Czechoslovakia was one of the largest expulsions of a given ethnic group after World War II, this was not a unique phenomenon of the times, nor were Germans the only transferees. The population transfers in East Central Europe between 1944 and 1948 included 31 million people, transferred voluntarily or involuntarily for a variety of reasons. The widespread and large-scale readjustments of borders between various countries of the region was accompanied by efforts to produce greater ethnic homogeneity within the new borders. To some extent, this effort succeeded. Thus, Romania, whose population was 72% Romanian in 1930, had an 88% Romanian population by 1977. Poland, whose population was 69% Polish in 1931, had a 97% Polish population in 1991. Czechoslovakia, however, despite its mass expulsions of Germans, had the proportion of Czechs in its population rise only modestly, from 51% to 54%, while the Slovaks rose from 16% to 31%. Hungary achieved a more than 99.5% Hungarian population by 1990. But this represented a relatively small rise in a population that was 92% in 1930. Most of this ethnic homogeneity in Hungary was a result of massive losses of territory to surrounding nations in the peace treaties following the First World War. Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was a very different story. It never achieved anything approaching ethnic homogeneity. While nearly three-fourths of the population spoke Serbo-Croatian in 1921, these included such separate and antagonistic groups as the Muslims, Croatians, and Serbs, whose racial and linguistic affinities did not prevent much mutual hostility and friction. In addition, there were numerous smaller minorities, including the Slovenes, less than 9%, the Germans, 4%, and the Magyars and Albanians, less than 4% each. More important than the number and size of Yugoslavia's ethnic groups was their hostility to one another, exacerbated by the ruling Serbs' heavy-handed treatment of them all. The country's political parties, with the exception of the communists, represented their own respective ethnic groups or geographical regions, and therefore had every incentive to aggravate intergroup and interregional frictions. having been assembled from remnants of Ottoman, Germanic, Hungarian, and Italian cultural regions, with various systems of government and even technologies, Yugoslavia was left with such anomalies as four different systems of banking, railroads, and currency when it became an independent state in 1918. Serfdom still existed in Macedonia and Bosnia-Herzegovina until it was abolished by a new government in early 1919. In addition to being a socially and politically fragmented country, Yugoslavia was a very poor country. The historic poverty of the Balkans was worsened by devastating losses of life and property during the First World War, in which the percentage of the Serbian population killed was more than twice as high as the percentage of the French population and three times as high as the percentage of the British population killed in the war. Between the war itself and a typhus epidemic that raged through Serbia, death claimed one-tenth of the entire Serbian population, one-fourth of their cattle, one-third of their horses, and one-half of their pigs, sheep, and goats. This traumatic experience left the Serbs not only much worse off economically, but also with a bitter sense of entitlement to both power and restitution from the resources of the new Yugoslavian state, which is to say, at the expense of the other ethnic groups who had been spared such devastation and who were in some cases formerly part of the defeated enemy states or empires. As in much of Eastern Europe, economic development in Yugoslavia owed much to imported technology, capital, and managerial expertise from Western Europe. An iron and steel mill was built in Yugoslavia by the German industrial giant Krupp, while the French built a copper refinery and the British a lead and zinc plant. The more advanced parts of Eastern Europe also contributed. Entire textile factories, including skilled workers, were imported from Czechoslovakia and Poland. In the last decade of the 20th century, Yugoslavia's existence ended as it began, in an embittered atmosphere among its peoples, whose antagonisms went back for centuries. The country's travails during the Second World War, in which the Croats collaborated with the Nazi invaders while the Serbs fought guerrilla warfare against them, did nothing to unify the people. Only under the iron dictatorship of the post-war communist government, headed by Josip Broz Tito, was an imposed unity maintained, and in the post-communist era, the country came apart in a civil war marked by some of the world's worst atrocities since the days of the Nazis. Achievements. Despite high illiteracy rates in some countries, regions, or ethnic groups in East Central Europe between the two world wars, 52% illiteracy in Yugoslavia and 80% in Albania, some of the leading figures in the world in mathematics, science, and the arts came out of this region, whose leading universities maintained high intellectual standards even when more basic education for the masses was neglected. These individuals of world stature included Polish mathematicians, Hungarian mathematicians and scientists, John von Neumann, Edward Teller, and Leo Szilard, for example, Czech and Polish linguists, Romanian and Yugoslav sculptors, and Hungarian composers such as Béla Bartók, not to mention prominent German and Jewish figures from the region such as Franz Kafka and Rainer Maria Rilke. However, many institutions of higher education in the region also turned out what has been aptly characterized as an economically superfluous and politically dysfunctional academic proletariat, for their students tended toward specialization in the softer fields, rather than in the science and technology in which the region lagged behind Western Europe. In Eastern Europe, as elsewhere around the world, such soft subject intellectuals have been major sources of intergroup polarization and political instability. Russian empires. Two Russian-dominated multinational empires succeeded one another on the same territory, the first being called candidly the Russian Empire and the second the Soviet Union. Geographically, Russia is in some ways like the rest of Eastern Europe, but its natural resource endowment is far richer. Like some other Slavic lands, Russia has vast plains, indeed the largest area of level land in the world, and the Ural Mountains, which mark the boundary between Europe and Asia, are modest in height, like the mountains of the rest of Eastern Europe. The sheer physical size of the Russian Empire and of the Soviet Union that succeeded it has had enormous consequences. The largest country in the world, the Soviet Union was more than twice the size of the United States and larger than the entire continent of South America. The European portion of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics constituted more than half of all Europe, even though it was only one quarter of the total land area of the USSR. Such vast regions encompassed a wide variety of geographic and climatic environments and great natural resources, but the distances involved created high transportation costs, especially since most of these resources, including waterways, were in the Asian portion of the country, while most of the population was in the European portion. A 1977 study, for example, showed that 90% of the energy resources of the Soviet Union were east of the Urals, while nearly 80% of the country's energy requirements were in the European part of the USSR. While there are many rivers in Russia, containing altogether 1/10 of the total river flow in the world, the practical economic value of these rivers is limited, and the largest are by no means the most economically important. Many Russian rivers flow northward into the Arctic Ocean or flow elsewhere into inland seas, rather than serving as outlets to the great ocean trade routes of the world. More than 3/5 of their drainage is into the Arctic Ocean. Russia's most famous river, the Volga, is by no means its largest. The Yenisei and the Lena each carries more than twice as much water. But the Volga's importance derives from the fact that it flows through regions of Russia containing 3/4 of the country's population and 4/5 of its industry and farmland. It is the longest river in Europe. Not surprisingly, the Volga has carried more shipping tonnage than any other Russian river or any river in the former Soviet Union. Russian rivers are often frozen for months each winter, reducing their economic significance still further. Even the role of the Volga is reduced by the fact that it typically freezes before December in the vicinity of Moscow and remains frozen until mid-April. At its southern end, the Volga flows into an inland sea, the Caspian Sea, like so many other Russian rivers. In natural resources, Russia stands out among the nations of Eastern Europe and of the world. In addition to having the world's largest reserves of iron ore and 1/5 of all the forested land in the world, the manganese deposits of the Soviet Union have been estimated to exceed those of every other nation except South Africa, and its actual manganese production in 1980 exceeded that of any other nation by at least double. The Soviet Union also led all nations in oil production for many years, producing from 10% to 20% of total world output. It has also had 1/3 of the world's natural gas reserves, and was for many years the world's leading producer of nickel. The USSR was self-sufficient in virtually all natural resources and exported substantial amounts of gold and diamonds. As of 1978, the USSR supplied nearly half of the industrial diamonds in the world. Yet all this natural abundance did not translate into a high standard of living for the Russian people or for the other peoples of the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, or the Commonwealth of Independent States, which succeeded them. Partly this reflected the high costs of extraction and transportation in a vast country without a network of waterways connecting the resources with the population centers. The enormously costly Trans-Siberian Railroad was built in hopes of making up for the lack of natural transportation routes between the resources in Asiatic Russia and the industry and population centers of European Russia. For much of the country's history, there was also a lack of human capital among a largely illiterate population. As late as 1897, only 21% of the population of the Russian Empire was literate. But even after education spread and an abundance of scientists and engineers were trained during the communist era, the government's emphasis on military uses of its resources kept living standards low. However, the de-emphasis of the military in the post-Soviet era did not prevent the continued, and sometimes worsening, poverty in the region, a fact which highlighted the political and legal obstacles to economic development, which may well have played a major role all along in the country's backwardness under czars, commissars, and then democratically elected governments. Conquests and cultures. Like many nations, Russia has been both conqueror and conquered. For more than two centuries, from the mid-13th century to the latter part of the 15th century, an area now known as Russia was part of the vast empire of the Golden Horde of Genghis Khan, an empire stretching from China to deep inside Eastern Europe and southward into the Middle East. However, the Mongols did not occupy and directly administer the Russian lands, as the Romans did ancient Britain. Rather, the Golden Horde exacted tribute from a Russian governmental structure left largely intact, though always subordinated to Mongol overlords, who were able to dictate policy and to choose princely rulers from among the Russians. There was no Russia before the Mongol invasion, and, though the conquerors did not attempt to create such an entity, indeed they played off the various local powers against each other, the net effect of the shifting military and political alliances over the centuries was that the Grand Duchy of Muscovy grew stronger. Eventually, the Muscovite state became powerful enough to challenge its overlords on the battlefield and thereafter to choose its own rulers independently, as well as to cease paying tribute. Then Muscovy began its own expansion in all directions, creating the Russian Empire under the Muscovite rulers, the Tsars. At its zenith, the Russian Empire extended continuously from Europe, across Asia, and across the Bering Straits into North America, until the sale of Alaska to the United States in 1867. While Russia was the dominant nation in this empire, it was at the same time one of the most backward countries in Europe, lagging far behind Western Europe in economic, technological, and commercial development, as well as having the lowest rate of literacy on the continent in the early 20th century. In earlier centuries, no one was more painfully aware of Russia's backwardness, or more determined to do something about it, than Tsar Peter the Great, who reigned from 1682 to 1725, and who made extraordinary efforts to learn about the technology of the West by going there in person, and in disguise as a workman. However, Peter's methods of introducing Western ways to Russia were not Western at all, but traditionally autocratic. Russian businessmen were ordered to Moscow, and told to produce woolen cloth for the state at cost, with profits being allowed on other sales if they succeeded, and with punishment in prospect for them if they did not. Peter had industries built, and the city of St. Petersburg built, not where geography or economics would dictate, but where he chose. As an economic historian put it, "Few more inhospitable sites in European Russia could have been found to establish a major economic and political center than the damp, cold, swampy St. Petersburg." The Urals were an area rich in iron deposits and timber for fuel, although distant from the most important domestic markets, and even farther from the few ports through which Russia's high grade of iron could be exported. The cost of Russian iron thus was made prohibitive by transport costs and the proliferation of intermediaries. While Peter the Great's attempts to bring Russia out of its backwardness focused on transferring the technology of Western Europe to his empire, India was at that point also more advanced than Russia in both industry and agriculture, so that its products and people were also in demand in the Tsarist Empire. Orders from Moscow in the 1620s instructed local officials in the province of Astrakhan to allow Eastern merchants to go up the Volga and trade, leading to the development of a colony of sojourners from India who played a major role in the commercial development of that region. Indeed, Indian merchants and moneylenders in the city of Astrakhan were more financially formidable than their more numerous Russian counterparts. Despite Peter the Great's many efforts to advance and westernize Russia in the early 18th century, much of the modern industrial development of Russia began only in the late 19th century, covering the last decades of the Tsarist era that ended in 1917. How much the strains engendered by this modernizing effort contributed to the coming of the revolution which toppled that regime is an open question. Not only were the vast majority of the Russian people illiterate peasants, many of these peasants lived both as subjects of an autocratic government and also as serfs to particular landowners until 1861. Most of the other large subject peoples were no better off, though many had very different lifestyles, such as the nomadic peoples of Central Asia. The lives and labor of the Russian masses were cheap to their rulers. The city of St. Petersburg was built largely with forced labor. Peter the Great tested Western and traditional methods of warfare in a staged battle, in which 20 men lost their lives. Between the nobility and the peasantry, there was little middle class. Businessmen were regarded not so much as assets to the country, but as prey for government, both the official treasury and individual corrupt officials. The social milieu in Tsarist Russia was one in which the nobility looked down with contempt on business and businessmen. With a vast and illiterate peasantry, a class of nobles who contributed little to commercial and industrial development, and an intelligentsia hostile to capitalism, it can hardly be surprising that Russia had to rely heavily on foreigners to modernize its economy. Foreigners. At the end of the 17th century, Peter the Great scoured Europe for scientists, craftsmen, and productive talent of all kinds to be brought to Russia to try to develop the economic and military strength of the empire. The first industries in Russia were founded by foreigners in the 17th century. The skilled labor used in these early industries, like their management, came from abroad. A whole colony of foreign craftsmen existed in St. Petersburg in the 18th century and in the Ukraine in the early 19th century, in addition to shopkeepers and moneylenders from India who operated in the province of Astrakhan. Armenian immigrants accounted for 40% of all exports and 53% of all imports through Astrakhan in the mid-18th century. Of 250 cotton cloth factories there at that time, 209 were owned by Armenians, who also owned 32 out of 38 silk weaving enterprises. From an early period, much of the economic and cultural development of Russia and its empire was a result of the importation of foreign knowledge and skills. Much of the Kremlin itself was built by an Italian architect. The Bering Sea, between Siberia and Alaska, was discovered by a Danish sea captain employed by the Russian government. Foreigners played a pioneering role in metallurgy, machine construction, and even government service in Tsarist Russia. These foreigners included both sojourners and permanent settlers, individual entrepreneurs and whole groups, such as the German farmers who settled in colonies on the Volga and the Black Sea in the 18th century. The Tsars themselves were of predominantly German ancestry. Catherine the Great was a German princess before marrying the Russian prince who became Tsar Peter III, whom she succeeded to the throne. Many of her male descendants later married women of German ancestry, creating a predominantly German line of Tsars. This was only part of a larger picture of a general cultural westernization of the Russian upper classes, which included their speaking French and being familiar with the literature, manners, and social thought of Western Europe. Such cosmopolitanism, however, further widened the cultural gap between the Russian elites and masses. Because of the huge size and large population of the Russian Empire, even modest economic progress in particular sectors could translate into vast quantities of output in absolute terms. Thus, by the early 18th century, Russia had the largest output of pig iron in Europe, though it lagged far behind Western Europe in the efficiency with which that pig iron was produced. In the middle of the 19th century, Russia produced more yarn than Germany. Nevertheless, as Russia advanced economically, the key roles in that advancement were played by foreign entrepreneurs and, to a considerable but lesser extent, by foreign capital. The first woolen mill in Russia was erected by the Dutch. The mining and processing of both iron and copper in Russia owed their beginnings to German and Dutch mining engineers. The oil fields of the Caucasus were developed by the English and the Swedes. The greatest era of industrialization in Tsarist Russia began in the 1890s and continued until the First World War. Even this late in Russian history, foreigners remained a dominant factor, supplemented by the work of domestic minorities, such as the Jews, the Baltic Germans, and educated Poles. From 1885 to 1913, the annual growth rate of Russian industrial production averaged nearly 6%. For the period from 1860 to 1913, Russia's industrial growth rate exceeded that of Britain, France, or Germany, and was comparable to that of the United States. However, the level of industrialization at which it started and ended was not as high as in Western Europe or the United States. Nevertheless, it was an impressive performance, and the 1913 level of output would not be reached again under the communists during the next decade. Most Russian international trade had historically been carried in foreign ships, and that remained so during the era of industrialization under the Tsars. Only 3% of Russian international shipping was in Russian vessels. In petroleum, nearly three-quarters of all invested capital in Russia was British capital. By 1899, at least 60% of all coal in Russia was produced by foreign companies. Nearly all electrical streetcars were Belgian. On the eve of the First World War, approximately one-third of the sugar mills in the country belonged to Jews, and these mills produced just over half the refined sugar in Russia. At about the same time, the second, fourth, and fifth largest producers of agricultural machinery in Russia were all British firms, the number one producer of such machinery in Russia being an American firm, International Harvester. The electrical construction industry in Russia was dominated by German firms, though a French subsidiary of Westinghouse was also significant. The pattern, as well as magnitude, of foreign economic activity in Russia provides clues to the sources of Russian economic backwardness. The foreigners specialized in providing what the Russians most lacked: technical and scientific skills, efficient and honest management, and to a secondary extent, capital. Russian managers were notorious for their inefficiency and corruption. A French observer in 1904 referred to the extraordinary waste, to be polite, that reigns among Russian administrators. Even after trained Russians began to emerge over the years into increasingly responsible positions, foreign firms were careful not to use Russian accountants. This business corruption mirrored a pervasive corruption in the Tsarist government, which was by no means stamped out under the communists or in the post-Soviet era. The scientific and technological superiority of foreign firms was based largely on their copying in Russia the latest advances already in use in Western Europe. While much capital flowed in from Western Europe, there was also much capital raised within Russia itself, which had its wealthy classes, even though the masses of Russians were very poor. Lack of capital was not the source of Russian backwardness. Lack of entrepreneurship and technology were the crucial problems. Once sound and reliable management could be found, and Western technology applied, large amounts of capital could be raised from Russians, as well as from Western European investors. While the foreign-owned firms were new to Russia, they were not untried pioneers, but usually affiliates, subsidiaries, or offshoots of firms with well-established reputations and long years of experience in Western Europe or the United States. It was the reliability of the managements that made the raising of vast amounts of capital possible from both inside and outside Russia. The proportion of foreign capital in major Russian industries was just under one-half in 1900, up from one-fourth in 1890. Even though the industries themselves were largely created by foreign entrepreneurs. In short, even at the height of foreign domination of Russian industry, most of the capital was Russian, and very little of it was supplied by the Tsarist government. What was lacking in Russia was not capital, but the ability to use capital. That is what the foreigners provided. Seldom were the foreign-owned firms in Russia's wholly-owned subsidiaries established with the foreign firm's existing capital. Russian capital and some Russian directors or managers were more common, though the foreign management usually retained controlling interest, even if this was less than 50%. The foreigners tended to handle what they were best at doing: internal management of the firm and assessments of technological and market possibilities. The Russian members often proved to be very useful in external relations, especially with corrupt government officials and with shrewd and scheming Russian elements with which the firm had commercial contacts. Foreign managers, unfamiliar with Russian ways, often met disaster in such external dealings. The managing of Russian labor was another large and growing problem for foreign entrepreneurs. The difficulty was not simply that the Russian workers were unskilled and unable to handle advanced Western equipment effectively, though these were factors that made the apparently cheap Russian labor costly in practice. Russian workers, often unused to the routine and rhythm of industrial life, tended to be transient or prone to absenteeism, in a word, unreliable. These problems were at their worst at the beginning, and in industries whose inherent work demands could not tolerate such behavior. When the steel industry was established in southern Russia, for example, almost all the steel workers were imported. However, the enormous costs of attracting workers from Western Europe, with wages high enough to compensate them for moving and for the dreary life in Russia, led to attempts to train and retrain Russian workers instead, wherever possible. Foreign workers were therefore a short-term expedient in the initial stages. Nevertheless, the resort to such expedients was indicative of another element of historic Russian economic backwardness. It was also difficult to get Russians to work well with foreigners. While work skills and experience would come to the Russian workers with the passing years, their hostility to foreigners would in many cases also grow, fanned by the rising radical movements that would culminate in the revolutions of 1917. In the short run, the resentments of the Russian workers toward foreigners sped up the Russification of the workforce in order to reduce a source of internal friction. These frictions were by no means incidental matters. In 1900, for example, rioting Russian workers burned the dwellings and belongings of 60 Belgian workers at a glass factory, causing them to flee back to Belgium. A report of a French firm in Russia in 1907 declared, "One must remember that the mass of workers has been heavily indoctrinated in these last years, and their nationalism has been overexcited. The consecutive assassinations of several plant managers have shown this all too clearly." In short, the same bitter resentments directed at more productive and more prosperous domestic minorities, such as the Germans and the Jews, extended to foreigners as well. Ironically, hostility to foreign exploitation was rising just as the return on foreign investments was declining sharply as a result of growing competition created by the inflow of more foreign businesses. Initially very high rates of return, 17.5% in 1895, dropped under 10% by 1898, under 5% in 1990, and under 3% by 1906. The prices of steel products, crucial to industrialization, also dropped sharply during this period as Russia became self-sufficient in this basic industry due to the hated foreigners in their midst. The large role of foreigners in Russian economic development did not end with the Tsarist regime. Only a few years after seizing power, years marked by numerous economic setbacks and catastrophes, the communists too turned to the West for management, engineering, and technical personnel, as well as for equipment and capital. Much effort and time were required merely to restore the economy to where it had been under the Tsars. As of 1920, Russian production of cast iron was less than 3% of what it was in 1913, and was in fact less than it had been in 1718 under Peter the Great. Similarly, Soviet production in the early 1920s was well below that of Tsarist times in platinum, agricultural implements, steam locomotives, heavy electrical equipment, tar, ammonia, and dyes, among other products. Although Tsarist Russia had such entrepreneurial pioneers of early aviation as Igor Sikorsky and Alexander P. Dessiversky, both moved to the United States after the Bolshevik Revolution and contributed in a major way to the development of the American aircraft industry, while the Soviets became dependent on foreigners for the design and production of their own aircraft, military and civilian, and remained so a decade after the Revolution. A massive inflow of foreign management, engineering, and technical personnel and capital restored vast areas of the Soviet economy. For example, although Russia under the Tsars had been the world's largest producer and exporter of oil, by 1921, Russia's oil drilling was less than 1% of what it had been at the turn of the century. An American company then began drilling oil wells in the Caucasus during the 1920s, while the Japanese were developing oil production for the Soviets in the Far East, on Sakhalin Island. Oil refineries were built by British, German, and American companies. The production of crude oil almost tripled from 1923 to 1928, as foreigners not only restored the industry, but also introduced more advanced technology. Much the same story unfolded in other sectors of the Soviet economy. The average monthly output of coal under Soviet management jumped immediately by more than 50% under American management, and the output of sawmills jumped by 75%. Such well-known German firms as Krupp and IG Farben also played major roles, as did such American firms as Ford, DuPont, RCA, and International Harvester. But many other countries were involved as well. Ball bearings came from Sweden and Italy, plastics and aircraft from France, turbines and other electrical industry technology from Britain. This influx of foreign personnel, equipment, and capital did not end with the restoration of the Soviet economy in the 1920s. Much of Stalin's building of socialism in the early five-year plans was in fact done by capitalists from Europe and America. As late as 1936, the Soviets reported about 6,800 foreign specialists at work in heavy industry alone, about one-fourth of them American engineers. The largest project in Stalin's first five-year plan was a steel mill designed by American engineers and based on a steel mill in Gary, Indiana. Soviet iron and steel construction in general, during the period from 1928 through 1932, was of American design, built under the supervision of American and some German engineers using equipment from the United States and Germany. Until 1930, the Soviet automobile industry produced only a Fiat truck from Tsarist times. The first new automobile factory under the communist regime was built by the Ford Motor Company in the early 1930s and was modeled after Ford's famous River Rouge plant. When the Soviets built the largest tractor plant in Europe, it was manufactured in the United States and later assembled in the USSR under the supervision of American engineers. W. Averill Harriman reported to the U.S. Department of State in 1944 that Stalin had said in a conversation that about two-thirds of all the large industrial enterprises in the Soviet Union had been built with United States help or technical assistance. Nevertheless, the dramatic restoration and advancement of the Soviet economy was seen by many, including many in the Western democracies, as a vindication of socialist planning in general and the communist economic system in particular. Indigenous nationalities. The Tsarist Russian Empire and its successor, the Soviet Union, were both very racially and ethnically heterogeneous societies. The country's census has listed more than 100 nationalities, more than 20 of them groups with foreign homelands. The census of 1897, for example, showed the Russians to be just 45% of the population of the Tsarist Empire, and the last census of the Soviet Union in 1989 showed that Russians were not quite 51% of the population of the USSR. This was not a country with a numerically predominant majority and a fringe of minorities. It was a collection of distinct nationalities, many numerically predominant within their own respective borders, and having distinct languages, histories, and cultures, as well as numerous smaller minorities within the borders of the member republics, some of these sub-minorities also having separate languages and cultures. Neither the Russian Empire nor the Soviet Union was simply a multi-ethnic society, such as those created by immigration in the Western Hemisphere or in parts of Southeast Asia. Lenin called the Tsarist Empire a prison of nations, though that term would later apply equally to the regime which he created. Unlike other conquering European powers which created empires overseas among militarily weaker peoples, Russia found vulnerable peoples and nations on its own land borders, especially to the south and east, but also to the west. Russia accordingly expanded militarily across contiguous nations on the immense Eurasian landmass to create the largest country on earth. Those conquered or annexed included not only whole nations, such as Armenia and the Ukraine, the latter larger than France, but also nomadic tribal peoples spread over vast reaches of land in Central Asia. There were more Muslims in the Soviet Union than in Egypt, and more Turks than in Turkey. The relationships of the Russians to the various conquered peoples of the Russian Empire and of the Soviet Union ranged across the whole spectrum of relationships found between conquerors and conquered elsewhere. In the Asian regions of the Russian Empire and of the Soviet Union, Russians brought a more advanced technology than the indigenous peoples were used to and settled in the cities, while the indigenes predominated in the surrounding countryside. In the Baltic, however, it was the conquered people who were more advanced and who maintained a higher standard of living than in Russia, on through to the end of the Soviet Union. The differences in technological, economic, and other advancement or backwardness were not simply a contrast between European and non-European peoples, however, for the Slavic Byelorussians likewise remained an agricultural people whose cities were inhabited largely by non-Byelorussians on into the 1920s, And it was the middle of the 20th century before Byelorussians became a majority of the urban population in Byelorussia. One sign of the wide range of cultural development among the peoples of the Soviet Union was that the literacy rate in 1922 ranged from less than 4% in Tajikistan to more than 80% in Latvia and Estonia. In general, Russians played a role among the peoples of Central Asia much like the role of Western Europeans in Eastern Europe, or like European imperial powers in much of the non-industrialized colonial world. That is, the Russians brought the technology, the organization, and the industrial and commercial way of life of Western civilization to these regions, if not always to the peoples of these regions, since the modern sectors of these societies were often Russian enclaves. In some respects, however, there were also important cultural changes brought to the peoples themselves. Some of these conquered peoples had no written language of their own, so that written versions of their existing languages had to be created by outsiders. More than 40 written languages being created between the two world wars, as had happened with Eastern Europeans centuries earlier. As in other parts of Europe in earlier times, the replacement of local dialects with a standard national language was a major transformation in itself, spread over many years. In the Soviet Union, the linguistic history of the innumerable national and ethnic groups was complicated by the fact that the creation of standardized and written versions of their languages and local dialects was often preceding simultaneously with attempts to get more of them to speak Russian, so as to participate in the modernization of the economy and society. In a vast, polyglot, supranational state, the Russian language was seen as a lingua franca that was especially needed to unify these sprawling domains and bring their economies up to a level that would enable the Soviet Union as a whole to be militarily viable in competition with more advanced nations in the rest of Europe. A further complicating factor was that education of any sort, in any language, was only developing in many parts of the Soviet Union, where just 40% of the whole population could read and write in 1926. With literacy rates being in the single digits in Siberia and Central Asia. Asian peoples long remained a predominantly pastoral or agricultural population in the countrysides, under both the Tsars and the Communists, while Russians and other Europeans settled in the cities to both run the modern economy and the political system. However, inter-ethnic relations were never a simple dichotomy of Russian conquerors and indigenous subjects, even within a given nation, in either Tsarist or Communist times. Because of the historic role of Germans, Jews, and other bearers of cultures deriving from Western Europe, the indigenes, both European and Asian, often found themselves playing economic and political roles subordinate to those of others besides the Russians. Thus, 19th century Latvians who migrated to the cities of their country found Germans predominant in urban economic and cultural life, as Lithuanians found Poles predominant, and as others found themselves economically or culturally subordinate to Jews, Armenians, or other more advanced groups, in addition to being politically subordinate to Russians. One consequence of this multi-ethnic subordination was that the resentments of the subordinate groups and nations were not directed simply toward the Russians, but toward other groups as well, such as the Armenians in Georgia. Therefore, even eventual freedom from Russian control after the end of the Soviet Union in 1990 did not lead to a subsiding of nationalistic frictions, but instead unleashed other inter-ethnic violence and warfare within the newly independent nations. One indicator of the foreign domination of indigenes in both Tsarist and Communist times was that the various subordinate nationalities long remained only a minority of the population in the cities of their own respective nations. Again, a pattern reminiscent of Eastern Europeans as a whole in previous centuries. Latvians, for example, were just 24% of the population of their capital city, Riga, in 1871. As late as 1897, only 28% of the people living in Ukrainian cities were Ukrainians, and only 33% of the people living in the cities of Georgia were Georgians. Even in 1918, 97% of the people living in the cities of Byelorussia were not Byelorussians. Policies toward the various indigenous nationalities did not remain uniform over space or time, either in the Tsarist Empire or in the Soviet Union. A crucial question in both eras was whether, or to what degree, to try to assimilate these conquered peoples to the Russian culture. Where the indigenous culture was already similar, as among fellow Slavs in the Ukraine or Byelorussia, assimilation seemed to be a more attractive option than among groups with more radically different cultures, such as the peoples of Central Asia. Thus, although the Orthodox Church enjoyed government support in European Russia under the Tsars, Catherine the Great promoted the spread of Islam among the Central Asians, wanting them to become more religious and considering that conversion to Christianity seemed less likely than spreading a religion which already had a foothold among them. Such decisions, however, varied over time as well as space, especially with the change of Tsars or even a change of mind during the reign of a given Tsar. Similarly, during the Soviet era, V.I. Lenin's more accommodating policies toward the non-Russian peoples gave way to a much more traditional colonial subordination of the non-Russian nationalities under Joseph Stalin, ironically himself a non-Russian. Although the official ideology of the Soviet era proclaimed the equality of all the various peoples of the USSR, and some serious gestures were made toward cultural autonomy and toward bringing non-Europeans into the industrialization process, the results were often meager. As of 1932, there was not a single engineer or technician among the 50,000 or more Tatars working in the Donets Basin, and, half a century later, Central Asians could still be characterized as largely unskilled members of the labor force. As in other similar situations, the costly expedient of moving outsiders in to supply the skills and aptitudes missing locally was increasingly resorted to in the Soviet Union after attempts to create local, industrially trained workers and educated elites proved to be too slow or too costly. Those Russians who settled or sojourned in other Soviet republics were not simply a random sample of the Russian people. They tended to be much more educated than the general population of the Russian Republic, as well as much more educated than the populations of the republics to which they went. They represented a large transfer of human capital, as well as a projection of Moscow's power and control. Nor were all of these, or other, Russians necessarily descendants of people who were part of the Russian population in earlier generations. An estimated 4 million people of non-Russian ancestry chose to identify themselves as Russians in the 1979 census, and presumably in their careers and lives. This too is part of a common part in other empires, of subject peoples redefining themselves as members of the ruling group. Both cultural and political autonomy for the non-Russian nationalities began to be cut back under Stalin in the interest of economic efficiency and political control. With the passage of time, and especially with the onset of industrialization in the late 1920s and early 1930s, the formal equality of all the Soviet nationalities and cultures was eroded by the growing reality of Russian domination. Study of the Russian language became compulsory in all non-Russian schools. The Cyrillic alphabet of the Russians was imposed on many nationalities that had traditionally used Latin or Arabic writing. Soviet historians began to rehabilitate Russian conquests of the other nationalities that had occurred during the Tsarist era, while the patriotic heroes, ballads, and literature of other peoples were downplayed or even suppressed. Nor were these by any means the worst examples of national repression. Terror was an instrument of state policy on nationalist issues, as on other issues. Thousands of people were killed in the Baltic republics. Byelorussians during the 1980s discovered mass graves of people killed during Stalin's purges of the 1930s. During the Second World War, there were mass deportations of whole peoples to the hinterlands, the Volga Germans and the Tatars, for actual or suspected disloyalty, and millions were killed in an artificially produced famine in the Ukraine during the 1930s. Systematic campaigns of destruction of elites in newly conquered territories in Eastern Europe began during the Second World War, when the Soviets massacred more than 14,000 Polish officers in the Katyn Forest and elsewhere. Those arrested and deported from Poland ran into the hundreds of thousands, perhaps more than a million. Even in the small Baltic nations, the people deported ran into the hundreds of thousands, again concentrating on elites with the potential for resistance. There was also a resurgence of officially promoted anti-Semitism in the USSR, though conducted under the guise of attacks on homeless cosmopolitans and other euphemisms. The death of Stalin in 1953 brought an end to some of the worst discriminations and oppressions against the non-Russian nationalities, and also brought some substantive concessions to their cultural autonomy and to the career ambitions of rising indigenous elites. The Presidium of the Central Committee of the Communist Party in Moscow announced in 1953 that someone native to each republic, and not a Russian sent from Moscow, should hold the position of first secretary of the Communist Party in the individual republics. Local shake-ups, in fact, brought more indigenous people into the political power structure in the republics. There were particularly striking changes in the Ukraine, where no Ukrainian had ever been head of the Communist Party prior to 1953, but where, from 1955 to 1972, more than 9/10 of all Politburo members were Ukrainian. Some of the nationalities deported en masse during the Second World War were allowed to return to their former homelands. While some of these changes were substantive, others were largely cosmetic. The nominally highest official of each republic, the first secretary of the Communist Party, now tended to be a member of the nationality of that republic, while the second secretary was usually a Russian. Despite the greater visibility of the first secretary, the second secretary represented party policymaking, as distinguished from the administrative functions of the first secretary, who was in effect subordinate. First secretaries generally spent their careers in their own respective republics, while second secretaries were transferred around the Soviet Union as representatives of Moscow. Although first secretaries tended to have greater longevity in office at a given location, it was they who were usually sacrificed in purges when things went wrong. This policy was one which evolved over time. However, the general direction of evolution was toward the pattern that became almost universal in the late 1970s, national first secretaries and Russian second secretaries. For the entire period from 1954 through 1976, local nationalities supplied 69% of the first secretaries of the various republics, while Russians supplied 61% of the second secretaries. Moreover, non-Russian second secretaries were not necessarily indigenous. In 1976, there was only one indigenous second secretary in the entire Soviet Union. In the Soviet government in Moscow as well, the representation of the various nationalities tended to vary with whether the position was one of real power or merely one of symbolic visibility. The various peoples of the Soviet Union were well represented in the Supreme Soviet, a parliamentary body which was far from supreme in a totalitarian state. Non-Slavic peoples were in fact overrepresented in the Supreme Soviet, holding 40% of the seats, though they were only 26% of the population. But the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet and the Council of Ministers were almost invariably chaired by a Slav, and the same was true of economic planning agencies and security forces. The Central Committee of the Communist Party, the Politburo, and the Secretariat were all overwhelmingly Slavic. In 1973, all secretaries of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union were Russians. Earlier, during the Khrushchev era, efforts were begun to bring non-Russians into leadership positions in Moscow, but by the early 1980s, Russian dominance among party leaders returned to the levels characteristic of the late Stalinist era. As of 1980, Slavs held all but three of the top 150 posts in the Central Committee of the Communist Party. In the military, among the generals appointed in the three decades between 1940 and 1970, an estimated 91% were Slavs. As of 1982, more than 80% of all Soviet commissioned officers were Russians, and well over 90% were Slavs. Among sergeants, more than half were Ukrainians. Nor did this general pattern change during the Gorbachev era, when the Soviet general staff was 98% Slavic, 85% Russian, 10% Ukrainian, and 3% Bielorussian. Heads of Soviet enterprises and projects outside Russia were often Russian as well. So were many heads of the secret police, the KGB, in the Soviet republics. Russians living in other republics often played an important role in the local Communist Party, though non-Slavs did not usually play an important role in the Communist Party of republics other than their own. The general pattern of population distribution during the Soviet era was that Russians spread out into other Soviet republics, but the peoples of these republics tended to remain concentrated in their respective homelands. As of 1959, Russians were one-fifth of the population of the Ukraine, one-fourth the population of Kyrgyzstan, nearly one-third of the population of Latvia, and just over 40% of the population of Kazakhstan. In the capital of Kazakhstan in Central Asia, much closer to China or India than to Moscow, 70% of the population was Russian. The Russian language was likewise spreading. The proportion of non-Russians using Russian as a first or second language rose from 48% in 1970 to 62% by 1979, but only 3% of Russians spoke a second language. They did not have to. Even those living in other nations seldom attempted to learn the national language. Of the tens of millions of Russians living in Central Asia, for example, fewer than 10% spoke a Central Asian language. And Russian students at a technological institute in Estonia during the Soviet era were openly proud to declare that they knew not one word of Estonian. Meanwhile, some Soviet nationalities were even more geographically concentrated in the USSR's last census in 1989 than they had been in 1926, before the Stalinist transformation of the economy and society began, causing a reduced concentration of many nationalities during the period leading up to World War II. A post-war reconcentration, however, left some nationalities even more concentrated by 1989 than they were at the time of the 1897 census in the Tsarist Empire. While 47% of Armenians lived in Armenia in 1926, 67% of them lived there in 1989. While 83% of the Turkmen lived in Turkmenistan in 1926, 93% lived there in 1989. These instances represented unusually large increases in concentration, however. More typically, there was a shift of a few percentage points toward greater or lesser concentration. However, the mere persistence of nationalities living in their own republics, more than 90% in the three Baltic states, was quite a contrast to the official ideology of one Soviet people. These nationalities were not dispersed in any way comparable to the dispersal of minorities in multi-ethnic societies such as the United States. During the last decade of the Soviet Union, rising indigenous leaders and rising nationalism in the Soviet republics led, among other things, to various preferential policies, notably in employment and university admissions for the predominant nationality in each republic. This provided an incentive not only for individuals living outside their republic to relocate to the official homeland, where they would receive preferential treatment, but also for the offspring of mixed marriages to choose their homeland identity for official purposes. The decade of the 1980s also saw an exodus of Russians from many republics, partly in response to the preferential policies for indigenous peoples, and partly in response to the local nationalism, which in some cases took an ominously anti-Russian turn. More than location was involved in nationalist identity, which was also cultural. As of 1979, 99% of Turkmenians spoke their own mother tongue, as did about three-quarters of the Bielorussians, four-fifths of the Ukrainians, and more than 90% of the Armenians, Lithuanians, Georgians, Kazakhs, and Uzbeks, among others. These proportions remained virtually unchanged at the 1979 census as compared to the census of 20 years earlier, and still remained very similar in the last Soviet census of 1989. Despite assimilationist pressures, these regional and language differences remained strong, and in some cases became accentuated. As the future of a unified Soviet Union came into question during the last years of the Gorbachev era, the fate of the large Russian minorities in other republics became a concern both to the leaders of those republics and to the Russians themselves. A 1991 poll showed that there was no non-Russian republic in which even one-third of the Russians living there considered themselves citizens of that republic. More than one-fourth of the Russians in non-Russian republics considered a mass exodus of Russians from their republic to be either likely or very likely in all but one of the 10 republics surveyed, and a majority of the Russians thought a mass exodus probable in three republics. Concern about such an exodus was especially acute in the Central Asian republics, where much of the technical and managerial expertise was in the hands of Russians. Ukrainians. The very name Ukraine means borderland. Much of the history of this vast region of the Tsarist Empire and the Soviet Union has been shaped by that geographic fact. Neighboring states have fought over and annexed portions of the Ukraine for centuries. Scandinavians, Poles, Lithuanians, Austrians, Turks, and of course Russians have ruled portions or all of the Ukraine in various eras. Ukrainians have been a conquered people for most of their history. At the same time, they have been part of the great Slavic majority, which was culturally and politically dominant in both Tsarist and Soviet times. Tsars referred to the Ukrainians as Little Russians, in contrast to the expression Great Russians, used to describe the central people of the empire. With independence, the Ukraine, the borderland, became simply Ukraine, since it was now no one's borderland anymore. Both terms will be used here, as appropriate to the times being discussed. In physical size, Ukraine is larger than any nation in Western Europe. Only three Western European nations, Britain, France, and West Germany, exceeded its population of about 52 million in 1990, of whom 72% were Ukrainian and 22% were Russian. Ukraine is also rich in natural resources and long served as a major food supplier to Russia and the rest of its empire. At the end of the Soviet era, the Ukraine supplied 1/4 of the grain in the USSR, as well as 1/4 of the beef, 1/3 of the vegetables, and half of the granulated sugar. Within the Soviet Union, only Russia had a larger population. A united Ukrainian nation has been the exception rather than the rule in history, and an independent, united Ukraine rare and fleeting. Kievan Russia, inhabited by the ancestors of today's Ukrainians, Russians, and Belarusians, existed from the 9th to the 11th century. Portions of the Ukraine began to break away, some as independent principalities, and others annexed as parts of neighboring states. Kievan Russia was then overrun in the 13th century by the Mongol hordes, led by the descendants of Genghis Khan. Kiev, the capital of today's Ukraine, was razed by the Mongols in 1240 AD. A century later, the Lithuanians conquered the Ukraine and began its history as a land fought over by Eastern European powers. The Ukraine was reunited in 1569, but under Polish rule. The Ukrainians' most famous fighters for independence from foreigners were the legendary Cossacks, bands of outlaws, adventurers, or guerrillas, who arose in the 15th century in response to Polish domination. The Ukrainians' attempts at independence failed, as did their attempts to ally themselves first with Russia against Poland and then with Poland against Russia. Instead, Russia and Poland divided the Ukraine between themselves early in the 18th century. Cossack uprisings continued in each part of the Ukraine with such severity that the Poles had to call in Russian military assistance on three occasions. The Cossacks were finally crushed in the Russian Ukraine in the latter half of the 18th century, and then Poland itself was partitioned, with its share of the Ukraine going to Russia, except for Galicia, which was annexed by Austria. Russian attempts to assimilate the Ukrainians and destroy their separate culture began early. In 1720, the Tsar forbade the publication of any books in the Ukraine, except for religious books, and these had to be in the Russian language. In 1804, teaching in the Ukrainian language was forbidden. Although the landed nobility of the Ukraine tended to accept cultural assimilation, the masses retained their folk culture, and during the 19th century, literary, historical, and general intellectual expressions of Ukrainian culture arose. Members of the Ukrainian nationalist group were arrested by the Tsarist authorities, and their leader sentenced to 10 years of penal service in Central Asia. New bans on publications in the Ukrainian language and on the importation of Ukrainian writings from abroad were issued. Meanwhile, outside the Russian Empire, in Galicia, the Ukrainian language and culture were permitted greater scope by the Austrian authorities. Early in the 20th century, an easing of Tsarist oppression following the 1905 uprisings in the Russian Empire allowed Ukrainian nationalism to surface again, with Ukrainian delegations to the Duma, or parliament, demanding greater cultural freedom. Far from acceding to these demands, the Tsarist government during World War I began a systematic destruction of the freer Ukrainian culture in Galicia, when their troops occupied it briefly. After the Tsar was overthrown in 1917, a Ukrainian People's Republic was declared, autonomous but affiliated with Russia. This was not acceptable to the Soviet authorities in Moscow, Although the communists had received only 10% of the votes cast in the Ukraine, a so-called All-Ukrainian Congress was called, consisting almost entirely of Russians, about three-quarters of whom were Bolsheviks, which proclaimed a Soviet Ukrainian government and called on Moscow's assistance. In response to this appeal, Russian troops invaded the Ukraine in January 1918 to impose a communist government under the control of Moscow. They were driven out by the forces of the Central Powers, led by Germany, and the resulting Treaty of Brest-Litovsk imposed as one condition the recognition of Ukrainian independence by the Soviet Union. However, the later defeat of the Central Powers by the Western Allies led to abrogation of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and a resumption of Soviet military operations in the Ukraine. A confused civil war reigned there until 1919, when the Soviet Union and Poland partitioned the Ukraine between them. 20 years later, the USSR took over the Polish area of the Ukraine, as Nazi Germany and the USSR partitioned Poland as a whole at the beginning of the Second World War. During the early years of Soviet rule in the Ukraine, Lenin attempted to pacify Ukrainian nationalism with concessions on language and culture. But the communist officials on the scene in the Ukraine, few of whom were Ukrainian, were much less conciliatory than Lenin. Only after direct pressure from Moscow in the mid-1920s did the communist rulers in the Ukraine allow more Ukrainian participation in the party and government, and more use of the Ukrainian language. This led to a kind of Ukrainian renaissance, which then went too far for Moscow. In 1930, under Stalin, the first major purge trials began in the Ukraine, a foretaste of what was to happen later in other parts of the Soviet Union. Of 259 Ukrainian writers who published in 1930, only 36 were still publishing in 1938. Of 115 Ukrainian Communist Party Central Committee members elected in 1934, only 3 remained in 1938. Even these purges were overshadowed by the massive famine that struck the Ukraine during the early 1930s, as Stalin's collectivization of agriculture disrupted production and produced both passive and armed resistance among the Ukrainian peasants. But the crucial factors in creating the famine were, 1, the ruthless extraction of agricultural produce by the Soviet government, even when it left the peasants without food, or in some cases, even without seed for the next year's crop, and 2, the sealing off of the Ukraine's borders with Russia, where far more food was available. Although the Great Famine of 1930 to 1933 had devastating impact across broad areas of the USSR, killing millions of people, the Ukraine was the hardest hit of all. Most of the deaths occurred in the Ukraine and in the regions of the North Caucasus where Ukrainians were concentrated. The desperation of hunger in the Ukraine drove the starving peasants to eat dogs, cats, rats, weeds, earthworms, and even some human corpses. Others defied armed Soviet troops to get at food, individually or in groups, often paying with their lives. Death by starvation was so widespread among the peasants that carts came daily to pick up corpses from the streets, the homes, and the countryside. In some places, the carts came twice a day. There was no way to bury all these bodies individually, so mass graves became commonplace. Altogether, an estimated 5 million people died in the Ukraine during the famine. Much more was involved in this famine than simply economic inefficiency or political indifference. The thoroughness and ruthlessness of the campaign of terror which accompanied the famine, and the widespread and often deadly purges of Ukrainian authorities and intellectuals which followed the famine, clearly indicated a policy to crush national resistance of all sorts in the Ukraine once and for all. The massive sufferings, horrors, and atrocities accompanying the famine-creating policies then provided an excuse for the purges that followed, as local officials were made scapegoats for these disasters, even though it was often the purged communists of the Ukraine who had from the outset warned Moscow that the food collection quotas imposed on Ukrainian agriculture simply could not be met, not even by starving the peasants. Despite the deaths of millions and searches and seizures of even minute quantities of food, the original collection goals were in fact never met. But another goal of greater importance to Moscow was achieved, the crushing of opposition in the Ukraine and the consolidation of Soviet power there. The calculated nature of Soviet policy was indicated by the fact that the worst starvation occurred in the food-growing areas, which were the centers of peasant opposition to collectivization of agriculture and also strongholds of Ukrainian nationalism. City dwellers in the Ukraine suffered malnutrition, but not starvation on the same scale as in the countryside, and extraordinary efforts were made to keep the peasants out of the cities, just as extraordinary efforts were made to keep Ukrainians from going to Russia to get food. Indeed, foreign offers of famine relief were refused by the Soviet government, which flatly denied that there was any famine in the Ukraine. One Soviet official at the time summed up the situation in a conversation with a fellow communist. "A ruthless struggle is going on between the peasantry and our regime. It's a struggle to the death. This year was a test of our strength and their endurance. It took a famine to show them who is master here. It has cost millions of lives, but the collective farm system is here to stay. We've won the war." Over the years, through all the stark and dramatic events and changing policies in the Ukraine, a slow erosion of the Ukrainian language proceeded. In 1936, schools conducted in the Ukrainian language served 86% of all the students in the Ukraine. By 1973, that figure had fallen to 60%. 40% of the schools were conducted in the Russian language, twice as high as the proportion of Russians in the population of the Ukraine. A similar trend appeared in the publication of scientific writings in the Ukraine. In 1946, the majority of scientific publications in the Ukraine were still being published in the Ukrainian language, but just 4 years later, more were being published in Russian than in Ukrainian, and by 1975, there were more than four times as many Ukrainian scientific journals published in the Russian language as in the language of the Ukraine. Ukrainian resistance took many forms, from informal cultural groups to nonviolent underground organizations working for secession. An estimated 40% of the political prisoners in Soviet labor camps were Ukrainians, and they were prominent in organizing protests and insurrections there. Still, Ukrainian resistance tended to be confined to intellectuals rather than the working class. Even after Ukraine became a sovereign nation, there were virtually the same number of Ukrainian schoolchildren being taught in Russian as in Ukrainian. During the Soviet era, Ukrainian culture was allowed more scope during the tenure in office of Petro Shelest, who, in 1965, became first secretary of the Communist Party of the Ukraine. In an apparent attempt to calm and co-opt Ukrainian nationalists, Shelest permitted more freedom of expression. For example, one Ukrainian writer was permitted to keep his job, even after publishing in the West a book critical of Russian treatment of Ukrainians. Shelest's removal in 1972 and the official denunciation of him for local nationalism and national narrow-mindedness signaled the limits of what the Soviet leadership in Moscow was prepared to tolerate. Demonstrations, firings, and arrests among Ukrainian nationalists all increased. Among the charges against the deposed Shelest was that his view of history was faulty in failing to see the Tsar's conquest of the Ukraine as ultimately beneficial. The political nature of these cultural issues was indicated, among other things, by the fact that some Ukrainian cultural expressions were permitted in Moscow and Leningrad that were not permitted in the Ukraine itself. There was no danger of igniting Ukrainian nationalism among the Russians. When the Ukraine proclaimed its independence on August 24, 1991, it marked the end of centuries of subjugation to foreigners in general and Russians in particular. Its independence was perhaps a greater shock to the Russians than the independence of any of the other former Soviet republics, partly because of historic, racial, and cultural ties between Ukrainians and Russians. Even as a sovereign state, however, Ukraine had a cultural life that was in many ways essentially Russian. Central Asians. The peoples most different from the dominant Slavs of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union have been the peoples of Central Asia. These differences have been racial, religious, linguistic, demographic, geographic, and historic. The vast reaches of Central Asia exceed in size all of Western Europe, but the Turkic, historically nomadic, and predominantly Muslim peoples of Central Asia are much more thinly spread over arid lands unable to support the population densities of Europe. Altogether, however, the population of Central Asia has been quite large, 49 million people in 1989, or about one-sixth of the total population of the Soviet Union. These 49 million people included about 33 million indigenous Central Asians, with the remainder being primarily Russians and others who migrated in large numbers into Central Asia over the years, as well as Germans, Tatars, and others forcibly relocated there during the Second World War in order to forestall their collaboration with the invading German-led Axis armies. One measure of the demographic impact of Russian colonization is that Kazakhs fell from 91% of the population of Kazakhstan in the middle of the 19th century to 57% in 1926 and to a low of 29% in 1962, before rebounding to about 40% by 1989 on the eve of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. In some years, under both the Tsars and the Communists, the Kazakh population declined absolutely as Russians took over some of their best land and imposed policies disrupting the indigenous way of life. Once of enormous importance in centuries past, when the Silk Road went through Central Asia to connect Europe and China in trade, or when Genghis Khan created the world's greatest land empire in the heart of the Eurasian landmass, this region became in later centuries an economic, military, and political backwater. The discovery of sea routes between Europe and Asia made the Silk Road no longer the prime trade route, since waterborne transport was so much cheaper than land transport, even when the water routes went around the African continent on the way to India and China before the Suez Canal was built. Suez and industrialization then left Central Asia on the periphery of world developments. Militarily, the progress of gunpowder weapons in general, and cannons in particular, put an end to centuries of dominance by warriors charging on horseback, such as those who came out of Central Asia in vast hordes to conquer and strike terror among the peoples of the Far East, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe. Once conquerors of China and overlords of Russia, the peoples of Central Asia were ultimately reduced to becoming the conquered subjects, first of the Chinese and then of the Russians. By the 19th century, Tsarist Russia controlled Central Asia, and in the 1920s, the communists under Stalin began to carve it up into the separate republics of Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Despite sweeping changes imposed on Central Asia from Moscow under the communists, there was no great knowledge or understanding of the indigenous peoples of Central Asia. Lenin had never set foot in any of this vast region. Under both the Tsars and the Communists, Russians moved into Central Asia, disrupting the traditional way of life there, as well as assuming political control. The herds of animals, on which so many nomadic Central Asians depended, found less and less area in which to graze, as Russians took over land and reorganized the economy. The American Civil War, cutting off cotton supplies to Europe, led to a great expansion and improvement of cotton cultivation in Central Asia, which remained the major producer of cotton for the Russian Empire and then for the Soviet Union on into the late 20th century. This and other agricultural ventures in Central Asia had serious environmental side effects, however. By 1990, the shrinking of the Aral Sea due to the demands of various crops for water caused its surface to shrink to little more than half its previous size and its volume of water to much less than half. If Tsarist conquest was disruptive to the traditional societies of Central Asia, communist rule was traumatic. The Civil War period following the Bolshevik Revolution took a heavy toll among both people and animals in Central Asia. In the brief period between 1917 and 1920, the number of livestock in Central Asia was cut in half. As for people, the famine of 1921-22 is estimated to have taken almost 1 million lives among Kazakhs alone. Collectivization under Stalin, beginning in the late 1920s, was likewise catastrophic for man and beast alike. Collectivization in Central Asia meant forcing nomadic peoples into fixed settlements, which was often fatal to herd animals that required huge grazing areas. The number of sheep and goats declined from more than 27 million in 1929 to less than 3 million by 1934. Over the same span, the number of horses fell from more than 4 million to less than 250,000. Among human beings, the number of Kazakhs declined by nearly 900,000 from 1926 to 1939. Some killed resisting collectivization, some succumbing to famine and others fleeing to China or Afghanistan. Kazakhs were the hardest hit, with most of their deaths being due to starvation or to famine-related diseases. Like many other colonized regions around the world, the Central Asian republics were artificial creations of the conquerors, following ethnic and linguistic lines only very roughly, and these republics contained many ethnic minority enclaves. Thus, there were substantial numbers of Uzbeks in Turkestan and Kazakhs in Uzbekistan, for example, with Kazakhs, in fact, constituting at one time a majority of the population in the area surrounding the Uzbek capital of Tashkent. As in other parts of the colonized world, this was not due solely to arbitrary boundaries drawn by the conquering powers, though these boundaries in Central Asia, as elsewhere, encompassed larger aggregations of people than had coalesced politically or culturally before. In addition, enclaves of both large and small Central Asian groups were scattered throughout the region, and large numbers of Slavs, mostly Russians, also moved into Central Asia. Education, urbanization, and industrialization were major goals of the Soviet government. However, dramatic increases in all of these over the years in Central Asia did not produce equally dramatic increases in education, urbanization, or industrialization for Central Asians themselves. Modernization of the region was led by Slavs, who relocated there in large numbers. The most extreme case was Kazakhstan, where Russians came to outnumber Kazakhs from the 1960s through most of the 1980s. By 1989, however, a higher birth rate among Kazakhs and an outmigration of Russians restored the Kazakhs as the most numerous group in Kazakhstan, though only 39.7% of the population, compared to 37.8% who were Russians. One sign of Russian domination of the region was that, while 63% of Kazakhs understood the Russian language, not quite 1% of the Russians in Kazakhstan understood the Kazakh language. In none of the Central Asian republics were the indigenous people a majority of the urban population, even though they were all a majority in the non-urban areas. The economic as well as political subordination of Central Asia was a pattern going all the way back to Tsarist times. Nearly 4/5 of the lowest skilled industrial workers in Turkmenistan in 1914 were Uzbeks, while more than 4/5 of the mechanized workers were Russians. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, only 7% of the workers in large-scale industries in Uzbekistan were indigenous. About a decade later, on the eve of the Nazi invasion of the USSR, indigenous workers had risen to 23% of the workers in large-scale industry in Uzbekistan. Yet, even in the 1970s, Uzbeks remained a distinct minority among the employees of various chemical, textile, machinery, and tractor manufacturing plants in Uzbekistan. As late as 1979, less than 1/3 of the people working on construction of a subway in Tashkent were indigenous. Only 10% of the pilots at Tashkent Airport were Asian, and, except for stewards, stewardesses, or workers in freight transport, only 14% of the air and ground personnel there were Central Asians. Most Central Asians in the Soviet Union's armed forces were assigned to construction units. Even when they were in units that handled advanced technology, Central Asians tended to do the less technical work in those units. Racial discrimination and racial epithets toward Central Asian soldiers were not uncommon. Extremely few of these soldiers ever became officers or re-enlisted. For many Central Asians, their military duties were distinctly unmilitary and did not involve being armed or receiving training in the use of arms. However, Central Asians were a majority of the troops in the internal security forces used to maintain order within the Soviet Union and included guards in prisons and at Gulag forced labor camps. In such roles, Central Asians had a rare opportunity to boss and bully Russians who were prisoners. They were noted for their cruelty in these roles. Although a majority of the people with middle-class jobs in Kazakhstan were of Russian, Ukrainian, or other ethnic origin, Kazakhs were half of the white-collar administrative personnel in the last years of the Soviet Union. However, they remained a small minority of the blue-collar workers, whether skilled, 3%, or unskilled, 11%. The Kazakhs thus followed a common pattern among newly educated members of lagging societies in seeking upward mobility via government bureaucracies. Despite a large Slavic presence in Soviet Central Asia, Intermarriages there were overwhelmingly marriages of Slavs with members of other Slavic groups, and marriages of Central Asians with members of other Central Asian groups. In a period of more than a quarter of a century, only 49 marriages involved a Kazakh woman and a Russian man, even though there were millions of Russians and millions of Kazakhs in Central Asia. Even among themselves, the Central Asians were not given to intermarriage. Most Uzbeks, 86%, married other Uzbeks. Most Kazakhs, 94%, married other Kazakhs. Endogamy among the smaller Central Asian peoples ranged from 77% among the Tajiks to 91% among the Turkmen and 95% among the Kyrgyz. Less than 2% of the children born to Uzbek women had fathers who were not Uzbek. Despite the distinctiveness of each Central Asian group, the social and cultural affinities among them have been demonstrated in many ways. When a Soviet Central Asian lived outside his own republic, it was usually in another Central Asian republic, just as marriage outside a given Central Asian nationality was usually marriage with another Central Asian of a different nationality. This cultural affinity among Central Asians has been demonstrated internationally as well. Central Asian troops in the Soviet Army in Afghanistan in the 1970s fraternized with the local Afghans, who were racially and culturally very similar. The Soviet government then replaced Central Asian soldiers with European troops. This reflected a long history of Russian distrust of Central Asians in the military, going back to Tsarist times. Despite an 1874 decree of universal military conscription, Central Asians were not in fact drafted until the desperate days of 1916, and their conscription then provoked an armed rebellion in Central Asia. Higher birth rates in the Central Asian republics have meant lower average ages in the population and more children. In the predominantly Slavic republics of the Soviet Union, Russia, the Ukraine, and Byelorussia, children under 10 years of age were an estimated 14 to 15% of the total population, and there were similar proportions in the Baltic republics. But in the Central Asian republics, children under 10 were from 22 to 30% of the population. Nearly two-thirds of all Russian families contained only 2 or 3 persons, while more than half of all Uzbek families contained 6 or more. In many ways, the relationship of the Slavs to the Central Asians was like the relationship of many European peoples to non-European Third World peoples, and like the relationship of Western Europeans to Eastern Europeans in earlier centuries. The Slavs in general, and the Russians in particular, dominated the economic, political, and intellectual life of Soviet Central Asia and led that region into modern urbanization and industrialization. They were the cultural conduits through which the ideas, the products, the technology, and the practices of European civilization reached Central Asia. It was the Tsars who stamped out slavery in Central Asia, impoverishing the Turkmen who lived by slave raids, leading to alcoholism and opium use among men whose chief preoccupation was now taken from them. How well Central Asians fared under the Soviets depends on whether the relevant comparison is with Russians, with their own past, or with similar peoples outside the USSR, in Turkey, Iran, or Afghanistan, for example. Per capita income in Central Asia ranged from 47% of that in the Soviet Union as a whole in Tajikistan to 74% in Kazakhstan in 1980. External comparisons seem more favorable. As of the middle of the 20th century, death rates appeared to be far lower in all of the Central Asian republics than in Iran. Doctors were far more available to the Soviet Central Asians, even in rural areas. The proportion of the population who were students in higher education was several times as large among Central Asians as among the people of Iran. From almost complete illiteracy before 1917, the indigenous people were by 1958 one-third of all students receiving higher education in Uzbekistan. Uzbeks far outdistanced Afghans in economic growth, medical services, or education. The Soviet government provided tours of Central Asia for neighboring Middle Eastern peoples. As with various other conquered peoples, the Central Asians gained economically, medically, and educationally from their association with a more technologically advanced society, but at a price. Successor states to the Soviet Union. Three small republics clustered together on the Baltic Sea, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia have populations that are individually not as large as the population of New York City and collectively not as large as that of Tokyo. Yet these three little nations began the process of secession, which ultimately dismembered the largest nation on Earth. The formal decision to dissolve the Soviet Union was made by the presidents of the three Slavic republics, Russia, Ukraine, and Byelorussia, without the participation of the dozen other republics or of Mikhail Gorbachev, president of the Union that now disappeared under him. The era of the Russian empires ended on December 31, 1991, when the Soviet Union was dissolved. Thereafter, Russians were rulers only of Russia, and 25 million Russians became expatriates in other nations formerly controlled from Moscow. The Commonwealth of Independent States, which superseded the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics on January 1, 1992, contained most of the nations formerly in the USSR, but their relationships to one another and to Russia were now quite different. To no one was the difference more apparent or more painful than to the expatriate Russians, now transformed into subordinate minorities in countries they once dominated. Even before the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Slavs in Central Asia had begun leaving in response to growing nativism and preferential treatment of the indigenous population in employment and university admissions. This exodus was on a scale that led to vacancies in skilled jobs that could not be filled by the Central Asian population, despite rising skill levels among the indigenous peoples. 250,000 Russians left Kazakhstan in 1992 alone. The varying degrees of economic prosperity among the Soviet republics seems also to have had little correlation with their desire to break away from the USSR. Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania were the most prosperous of the Soviet republics, yet these Baltic nations were the first to declare their independence, even in the face of both economic and military reprisals. Moreover, unlike most other Soviet republics, the Baltic states refused to join the USSR's successor, the Commonwealth of Independent States. Conversely, the Central Asian republics, which remained among the poorer nations of the USSR throughout its existence, were also among the least anxious to become independent, and Gorbachev, in fact, found one of his staunchest allies in the vain effort to preserve the Soviet Union in Nursultan Nazarbayev, president of Kazakhstan. Part of the reason for this pattern may be that the more prosperous republics, including Russia, were consuming less than they produced and were, in effect, subsidizing the poorer republics like those in Central Asia, which were consuming more than they produced. Economic ties among countries that had been Soviet republics continued to varying degrees, not only among those who became members of the Commonwealth of Independent States, but also among the others, including the Baltic republics, whose secession had begun the disintegration of the USSR. The Russian ruble, for example, continued to be used as currency until Russia's runaway inflation and subsequent central bank issuance of a new ruble with arbitrary limits on convertibility of the old into the new led various former Soviet republics to begin issuing their own national currencies. However, the regional specialization in production within the Soviet Union and transportation networks adapted to that specialization continued to affect trading patterns among the former Soviet republics, even as they began the process of seeking additional trading partners. Nevertheless, the process of transition, not only from being a single economic unit, but also from the discredited communist system under which all had operated, to others with which they were unfamiliar, led to significant declines in living standards among the former Soviet republics as they groped toward their respective new arrangements. Slavic emigration. The transatlantic mass migration of Slavs began much later than that of Western Europeans. Because immigration across the Atlantic tended to follow trade routes during the Age of Sail, regions without large-scale trade with the New World sent few immigrants. With the advent of transatlantic steamships, however, all passenger voyages became economically feasible, which in turn freed immigration from its dependence on trade routes. This provided the peoples of Eastern Europe, the Balkans, and Mediterranean Europe with the same access to the New World already enjoyed by Western Europeans. Between 1880 and 1914, more than 4 million people emigrated from Eastern Europe to the Western Hemisphere, 90% of them to North America. Nearly 2 million of these emigrants were Jews, but Slavic emigrants included more than 1 million Poles and hundreds of thousands of Russians and Ukrainians, among others. During the era of mass migration from Eastern Europe, wages were several times as high in the United States as in the Slavic homelands, and the Canadian government was actively recruiting immigrants with the lure of free homesteads on the western prairies, where most of the Eastern European immigrants to Canada settled. The United States became the principal destination of Slavic overseas migrations, as of European overseas migrations in general. However, there were Slavic communities in such widely scattered countries as Brazil and Australia, as well as closer to home in France, Germany, and Britain. There were Poles, Czechs, and Croatians among the people attracted to Australia during the mid-19th century gold rush there. During the 1920s, emigrants from Yugoslavia worked primarily as miners in France, Belgium, and Holland. During the 20 years between the two world wars, more than 2 million emigrants of Polish nationality left their homelands, and about 900,000 returned. France was the largest single recipient, with more than 622,000 Poles, of whom nearly a third returned. So did more than 90% of the approximately 475,000 who went to Germany, long a destination of seasonal migrations of Poles for agricultural work. But of the approximately 272,000 Poles who went to the United States during the same period, fewer than 12,000 returned. Overseas migration was, of course, not the only kind of migration in Eastern Europe or elsewhere. At the beginning of the 20th century, at least one-fourth of the entire adult male population of Eastern Europe had lived or worked somewhere other than where they were born. Movement across the Atlantic was therefore an extension of a tradition of migrations that already existed before transoceanic travel became feasible. Seasonal migrations of Poles for agricultural labor was much more common in Europe than in the United States, where only about one-fifth of Polish immigrants worked in agriculture, compared to Germany or Latvia, where the overwhelming majority did. Immigration to South America was also significant, and varied significantly in its occupational makeup. As of the early 1940s, there were more than 110,000 Poles in Argentina, and between 115,000 and 150,000 in Brazil. For the entire period from 1927 to 1938, only 10% of Polish immigrants to Brazil worked in agriculture, compared to 62% of those who went to Argentina. Mass refugee flights have been a major part of the emigration from Eastern Europe. On the eve of the Second World War, the Polish community in France numbered nearly 500,000 people, fewer than 10% of whom had been born in France. During the war itself, millions of people from Eastern Europe were sent to Germany to work as slave laborers, 3.5 million Poles alone by the time the war ended. In the post-war era, more than 2.5 million people fled from communist East Germany before the Berlin Wall was built to stop them. That was 15% of the total population of the country. While Western European countries regained their independence at the end of the war, much of Eastern Europe became satellite nations with puppet governments installed and controlled by the Soviet Union. Contrasting living standards, as well as differences between democratic and communist societies, led to mass emigrations out of these countries. In the 5 years marking the end of World War II and the immediate post-war period, more than 20 million people fled westward from Eastern Europe. Not all these people were Slavs by any means. This number does not include those who died en route, or those refugees who fled from one part of Eastern Europe to another. It also does not include 1.5 million Poles deported to the Soviet Union. During a century of emigration from Eastern Europe, beginning in the latter part of the 19th century, the fate of Slavic emigrants in the countries to which they went reflected the levels of skills and capabilities they had achieved, or failed to achieve, in Eastern Europe. Among the emigrants from Russian-held Poland during the decade from 1893 to 1903, 42% were landless peasants, and another 14% were agricultural laborers. Moreover, the agriculture they practiced was a backward agriculture. By contrast, those Poles from the part of dismembered Poland annexed by Prussia came from an area with a more prosperous agriculture and also had some industrial and artisan skills, such as those common among Germans. Among Polish immigrants to the United States during the era of mass immigration, only about 1 in 16 had a trade, though they were noted for their ability to save from meager earnings, even when that required them to live on stale bread and sausage. Yet, of those Polish immigrants who did have artisan skills, most came from Prussia. As for the professions, these occupations were so rare that there were more Polish domestics than professionals in most of the countries to which they immigrated in substantial numbers from 1927 to 1938, neither figure, however, reaching 10% during that time. The Australian census of 1933 showed that the great majority of Croatians working there were in unskilled manual occupations. The majority of Czechs in Australia at the same time were also unskilled workers and agricultural laborers. Even the post-World War II immigrants from the Ukraine were mostly unskilled and semi-skilled. None of these patterns has been fixed in stone, however, even for the historically brief period of a century of mass overseas migration from Eastern Europe. During more than six decades of substantial Czech emigration, the occupations of the emigrants changed from predominantly agricultural to predominantly skilled labor. A study of Carpatho-Russian males in Minneapolis showed that, while 55% of those in the first generation were unskilled, this fell to just under 10% for the second generation and to 3% for the third generation. Eastern European immigrants to the United States as a group had, by 1980, higher earnings than other white Americans, and also had more years of schooling. In part, this reflected their being more urbanized and slightly older. Nevertheless, this also represented dramatic changes over the generations. While just 22% of men from Eastern Europe who were born from 1905 to 1914 reached professional, technical, or managerial occupations, nearly 45% of those born between 1935 to 1944 did so. 30% of all Eastern European men of all ages living in the United States were in managerial and professional specialties in 1980, ranging from 20% among Slovaks to 48% among Russians. Among women, 25% were in these occupations, ranging from 18% among Slovaks to 37% among Russians. These indicators of dramatic increases in human capital among Americans of Slavic ancestry reflect not only their taking advantage of the opportunities available in the United States, but also, to some extent, reflect advances of Slavs and Slavic nations in general. Summary and implications. The history of the Slavs, like the history of the British, illustrates the enormous importance of human capital, and especially of the transfer of human capital. From primitive beginnings as an illiterate tribal people in medieval Eastern Europe, Slavs achieved not only literacy, but also a world-class literature, and advanced into the modern industrial and commercial world economy, with the aid of numerous cultural transfers from Western Europe and the United States. Not only the physical embodiments of Western European civilization, such as plows, coins, and printing presses, moved eastward, so did knowledge, alphabets, and ideas. For centuries, Germans were especially prominent among the many non-Slavic peoples whose industrial and commercial roles within Slavic Eastern Europe and the Balkans were crucial to the modernization of these regions. Not only did such outsiders create much of the industrial and commercial sectors of the economies of many Slavic nations, they helped create within the Slavs themselves industrial and commercial experience, skills, and aptitudes, such as developed among the Poles of Prussia and the Czechs of Bohemia. While one result of this historic role was a general prestige of things German among the Slavs, another result was resentment against the Germans that erupted sporadically into violence, from the riots in Krakow in 1312 to the riots in Bohemia in the 19th century, and the slaughters and mass expulsions of ethnic German civilians from Eastern Europe and the Balkans at the end of World War II. Such ambivalent reactions to those supplying more advanced human capital has not been confined to Slavs by any means, but was also part of the reaction to the British in India, Jews in Spain, Indians in East Africa, overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia, and many other groups in a variety of other countries. Nor was Slav hostility to more economically advanced groups in their midst confined to Germans. Eastern Europe also became one of the most virulent centers of antisemitism in the modern world. With the passing of centuries, Slavs eventually began to produce, with their own people, individuals of worldwide stature in mathematics, the sciences, and the arts. Indeed, individuals of recognized genius began to appear among the Slavs, the great Russian novelists of the 19th century, for example, long before the masses had achieved literacy, or the countries had achieved industrial or commercial competence, much less political freedom or even stable governments in some cases. The human infrastructure of democratic and economically advanced nations, the collective achievements, economic experience, and evolved traditions necessary for general economic and political advancement remained lacking in Eastern Europe and the Balkans long after individual geniuses had arisen among the Slavs in a number of fields. The mass production of university graduates was no substitute for this more fundamental kind of human capital growing out of experience. On the contrary, large numbers of people with degrees but without skills added to the bureaucratization and political instability of the Slavic lands of Europe. In many cases, the political institutions of modern Eastern European nations were borrowed from Western European nations, the constitution of Czechoslovakia, for example, being like that of Britain. But what could not be borrowed were the history and traditions that made those institutions work. In the ethnically fragmented and embittered world of East Central Europe, as it emerged after the First World War, the parliamentary institutions that the nations of the region began with often proved to be unworkable. In nations with proliferations of small and often ethnically based political parties, ruling coalitions of these parties rose and fell with sometimes tragicomic frequency, making stability of laws and policies virtually impossible to achieve. In economies so poor that access to the public treasury was by far the most promising road to wealth, politics was often a desperate struggle for office that turned into an extremist war of each against all. In countries with no traditions of free government or the self-restraints necessary for such governments, the virulence of the press was matched by political violence in the streets and, in the case of Yugoslavia, exchanges of gunshots during parliamentary debate, with a party leader being killed in parliament itself during one of these exchanges. As parliamentary government thus discredited itself in much of East Central Europe between the two world wars, such governments succumbed to coup d'états and authoritarian rule in Poland, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Romania, and Bulgaria. In the Russian Empire, the life of free parliamentary government was even shorter, lasting less than 1 year in between centuries of authoritarian rule under the Tsars and then communist totalitarianism that dominated the country for nearly three-quarters of a century afterward. Indeed, the strongest challenge to the democratic traditions of Western Europe and its offshoot societies in the Western Hemisphere and Australasia came governmentally from the Soviet Union and its ideological allies around the world, though the central theory of that ideological challenge, Marxism, was another import to Eastern Europe from the West. Even under ruthless totalitarian governments, the Soviet Union was plagued by the same kind of ethnic fragmentation and nationalism that created such havoc in the rest of Eastern Europe and in the Balkans. Whole regions defected from the USSR at various times, immediately after the revolutions of 1917, during World War II, and in the waning years of the Soviet government in the last decade of the 20th century. Only the forcible military intervention of the Red Army restored the defecting territories in the first two instances. Loyalty to the state varied greatly among the nationalities, both in Tsarist times and in Soviet times. Some small tribal groups absorbed into the Russian Empire readily accepted the higher cultural level of the conquerors. Other small immigrant and refugee groups who sought sanctuary in Russia from China, the Ottoman Empire, or Iran likewise became and remained loyal members of the host society, even when they retained their own cultural distinctiveness. However, other Soviet nationalities resisted in innumerable ways, from non-cooperation to armed rebellion, despite the heavy penalties for such resistance. The degree to which Russian hegemony was accepted was not always, or even generally, along lines of racial or cultural affinity. Ukrainians are racially and linguistically much closer to the Russians than are the Armenians, but the latter seem to accept the Russian-dominated government more readily, perhaps because grim historical experience left them few viable alternatives, nor was the loyalty of the given group always the same over time. Germans, who fought loyally for Russia against German invaders in the First World War, collaborated with the Nazis during the Second World War. However, the racially very different Tatars also collaborated with the Nazis against the Soviets. The impact of Soviet policies, notably collectivization, seems more highly correlated with the responses of the various Soviet nationalities than their degree of racial or cultural similarity. An historical assessment of the net impact of conquest is no easier in the case of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union than elsewhere in the world. Sheer pacification has been an enormous benefit wherever and whenever it has occurred, whether in the Scottish Highlands or in parts of Africa, and so it was in the Russian empires under both Tsars and Communists. A distinguished scholar, and one by no means pro-Russian or pro-Soviet, has stated, "Azerbaijan was in a state of feudal anarchy when the Russians moved in, bringing with them a peace and order that Transcaucasia had not known for centuries." For some parts of the Tsarist Empire, and later of the Soviet Union, the classic patterns of Western imperialism emerged: material progress accompanied by political and psychic oppression, the extraction of minerals and agricultural raw materials, and the installation of modern industrial technology, largely run by Europeans. Central Asia was the clearest example of this. However, some other parts of the USSR were more economically and culturally advanced than the conquerors, and remained so. Income per capita in Estonia and Latvia, for example, was about one-third higher than in Russia during the Soviet era. However, even in the poorer Central Asian republics, it would be hard to argue, as some theories of imperialism do, that their peoples were exploited, and that this explains the greater prosperity of the imperialist nation, since net transfers of wealth were toward the Central Asian republics. The whole range of imperialist relations with conquered peoples existed within the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Though both the Tsarist and the Communist empires were very much like those of other European powers in many respects, the Soviet Union was unique in that its empire expanded in the post-World War II era, while the empires of other European nations declined and virtually disappeared as colonies around the world gained independence. During the same era, Soviet influence and control of other nations grew, not only in the contiguous Eastern European bloc and Afghanistan, but also in overseas affiliates such as Cuba and Ethiopia. In racial or ethnic terms, Russian domination extended not only throughout the Soviet Union, where Russians were a bare majority, but also to the entire Warsaw Pact bloc, where they were little more than one-third of the population, and to the worldwide Soviet bloc, in which Russians were less than one-fourth of the population. Beginning in the late 1980s, however, Russian hegemony rapidly eroded and then vanished in Eastern Europe, and began to be challenged even within the Soviet Union itself, foreshadowing a disintegration characteristic of other European empires. In this broader historical perspective, the question is not so much why the USSR collapsed, but why it lasted so long after Western imperialism had faded elsewhere. Stronger government control, ruthless purges, and mass slaughters had much to do with the differences. So too did a carefully fostered image of being anti-imperialist, an image widely accepted and often repeated among Western intellectuals, thus exempting the Soviet Union from many of the criticisms and pressures generated against the imperialism of Western European countries or the United States. In its domestic policies as well, the Soviet Union benefited from the protective efforts of a large and prominent segment of Western intellectuals to ignore or deny its failures. The man-made famine in the Ukraine during the 1930s, for example, was ignored, downplayed, or denied outright by such prominent Western intellectuals as George Bernard Shaw and the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Walter Duranty, even though the facts that finally came out during the last days of the Soviet Union under Gorbachev showed that even more people were killed in that famine than the millions estimated in Robert Conquest's chilling and monumental study, Harvest of Sorrow. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn put it, "The whole atrocity of communism could never be accommodated by the Western journalistic mind." Just as Russia drew upon Western civilization for its own development over the centuries, so it became the conduit through which the fruits of European economic and technological development reached Central Asia and other less economically developed areas. Both economically and in terms of the cultural level of its masses, Russia was backward by European standards, but it was advanced by the standards of many non-European societies. In the 19th century, Russian manufactured products found a rapidly growing demand in Central Asia, even though these same products could not compete in either price or quality in the markets of Western Europe or North America. The vast changes produced by the diffusion of European technical and cultural advances were testimony to the huge disparities in productive capabilities among various national and ethnic groups at the same point in time. The political response to those disparities was often resentment, whether it was the resentment of Russians toward the foreigners developing their country, or to more advanced domestic minorities like the Jews and the Germans, or the later resentment of less developed Central Asians toward the Russians. As in many other parts of the world, there has been a continuous conflict between the economic benefits and the political turmoil created by the utilization of other people's knowledge and skills. When conquest has been the mode of cultural diffusion, resentments have been especially bitter and especially long-lasting. The official ideology that race did not matter under communism, that all were one Soviet people, was ultimately exposed as a bitter mockery when the easing of central government control in the late 1980s released lethal inter-ethnic violence in Soviet Georgia, in Azerbaijan, and in Central Asia. Many lives were lost in these inter-ethnic clashes, which required the deployment of thousands of Soviet troops to maintain control. The final irony was that racial, ethnic, and nationality clashes, all regarded as passing anachronisms by Marxist theory and as having been abolished by Soviet practice, not only persisted, but themselves played a major role in abolishing the Soviet Union. The cultural history of the Slavs of Eastern Europe during the 20th century cannot be separated from the history of the communist system which reigned for nearly three-quarters of a century in the Soviet Union and for more than four decades of Soviet hegemony over the satellite nations of Eastern Europe. The political and economic consequences of the communist system included the priorities which that system enabled its rulers to impose on vast millions living under their rule. Thus, the Russian leaders' goals, from becoming a global nuclear superpower to the technological feats of space travel to producing top Olympic athletes, could be achieved in spite of whatever costs this imposed on the Eastern European people's living standards or their freedom. In the decades leading up to the collapse of the Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe, this region became the only one in the industrialized world in which infant mortality rose and adult lifespan declined. It was also a region whose environmental degradation exceeded anything seen in industrial nations outside the communist bloc. Despite the greater freedom made possible by the collapse of communist dictatorships in Eastern Europe, the degree to which such freedom emerged varied, largely according to whether particular republics had had experience with freedom before. Czechoslovakia, for example, resumed its democratic form of government from the interwar years, but Yugoslavia not only failed to create the democratic institutions it had never had, it degenerated into ethnic civil war, with hideous atrocities unparalleled since the days of the Nazis. This suggests that an important part of a country's human capital is political as well as economic, and includes the experiences and traditions necessary to make the formal institutions of free government viable. The history of the collapse of democratic government in East Central Europe between the two world wars, as well as the collapse of such governments in the second half of the 20th century in Africa and other places where such free governments had never existed before, reinforces the conclusion that political human capital is among the intangibles, without which the tangibles do not work. Certainly, the vast, rich natural resources of Russia and the scientific and technological capabilities to use them make it virtually impossible to explain the poverty of the country without recognizing the great importance of the intangible framework of dependable law, without which a market economy cannot produce the prosperity that it produces in those other countries where this framework can be taken for granted. The independence achieved or re-established in the last decade of the 20th century by the nations of the former Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe opened new prospects of cultural, economic, and political developments in those nations and for the Slavic peoples as a whole. Perhaps nothing so captures the uneven achievements of the Slavs as the fact that the first human being to orbit the Earth was a Slav, Yuri Gagarin, and the fact that one of the most momentous breakups of a major world power in the 20th century was that of the Soviet Union.